It is glorious. We have no snow.
Same with you, Mary.
We'll call the meeting to order. This is the State Government Finance Committee meeting for December 6th. Welcome to everyone. And we have a full agenda today. We're going to hear from a lot of folks following up on things that we did or discussed as a committee during the last session. You have in your packet the minutes from a short meeting. Last meeting we had last spring. Would someone move those minutes?
So moved.
Moved by Representative Winkler.
Second.
Any additions or corrections to the minutes?
No. None whatsoever. Is that here?
Seeing none, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Well, we're very pleased this morning to have a couple of our colleagues with us who have been working now for a long time on a whole variety of government redesign efforts and working with cities, counties, school districts, townships. And they're going to give us an update today along with colleagues from all of those different organizations as to what they've been doing. Members, you'll recall Mr. Tony Murphy, when he was with us last spring, he piqued a lot of interest on the part of the committee in what was happening in Beltrami County, and there have been a lot of other good things happening throughout the state of Minnesota, and we're going to hear more about that here this morning. They've got a whole long list of folks that are going to be sharing some information and update with us. So Representative McFarland, Representative Loeffler, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're really excited here to share the work of the House Redesign Caucus, a bipartisan group that's come together, and share what we've been doing during the interim, especially. And I will mention that we do have handout folders with handouts in them, which was a lot of the information that was used in the local government redesign innovation sessions across the state, so, and some other things. So just for your reference. And I'd like to turn it over to Representative Loeffler.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee and members of the audience. The bipartisan House Redesign Caucus began in 2010. I actually think it was a brainstorm of Representative Marquardt, who brought together Representative Erdahl, Representative McFarlane, myself, as the bipartisan co-chairs, but we opened it up to, as we always do with these caucuses, to all members of the House, and a wide variety of people from both caucuses have participated since then. And its focus has always been about how to discover, encourage, and implement new ideas and how to redesign and government services, how to make us more efficient and more focused on outcomes, how to make ourselves as a legislative body more welcoming to innovation in new ways of delivering services. And in 2010, the caucus supported and reviewed a lot of legislation that came from a variety of groups, both inside and outside the Capitol, the Commission on Service Innovation, the Itasca Project, a variety of issues in human services, including the Service Delivery Authority. And so there's been ideas in the past that have certainly come from outside. But this year, we actually kind of took it a step further. The first year, we actually asked the public throughout the state for ideas that they thought we should be thinking about in addition to the ideas generated by our members. And this year, we made it even a broader invite, and I think Carol did a really great job of bringing in all kinds of different voices from the public and the private sector and nonprofit sector to share their ideas about how we as a state can be on the cutting edge again of innovation and delivery services. There's more ideas than we can all possibly hear, and many of them belong more appropriately in some of the specific committees, but we did hear from a lot and decided to spend some time over the interim hearing from more voices, particularly our local government partners. And I'm going to let Representative Farling tell us about that.
Thank you. Back on May 9th, we had a legislative redesign smorgasbord that was held at the History Center. And we had about 120 members attend, and that was both House and Senate, both bodies, and a lot of people from foundations, associations, unions, you name it, we had a lot of representation. And the conversation started there. It was hosted by the History Center and supported by the Minneapolis and St. Paul Foundations. We had a taste of redesign efforts that had happened in the past and those that we were working on as we move forward. After the session, we had a little interruption this summer, so we didn't get to go do the working groups as we had talked about. But the thought came that we should really carry this message of the initiatives that were at the redesigned smorgasbord across the state and start letting people that are the decision makers in our cities, counties, and townships, or cities, counties, and school boards come together and see what we could do as a unit. We chose to work with the big three because AMC, LMC, and MSBA had already had discussions about redesign and had their Navigating the New Normal project that they had done together. We did not want to slight the townships. I think there's plenty of opportunity for them to come and join everybody as we go on, but we felt the big three had already had some workings together. And we also had the, so we started to talk about how we could go across the state. And then we had great support of the foundations that came forward, the foundations that support the Beyond the Bottom Line effort, so that they would like to help. That includes the Blandon, Bush, Minneapolis, Minnesota Community, Northwest, and St. Paul foundations. And the support of their staff and the funding made it possible to have in commons facilitate the local government redesign innovation centers sessions across the state. More than 400 local leaders, interest in collaboration and willing to experiment for better outcomes met in 6 regional meetings across the state: Rochester, Hibbing, Bemidji, Marshall, Waite Park, and Eagan. Each partner was charged with representation of decision makers, elected and administrative people, to participate. The legislators were there to be supportive, not to really lead, but to be there in case anybody needed assistance. I want to also say I was really pleased at the fact that it was a nonpartisan, open-minded discussions that happened, and I think that was really healthy. And as we know, not all redesign needs legislation, but we as a redesign caucus stand willing to help if any ideas come forward that do need their assistance. We're really excited about all these things. I want to comment about these weren't just any local leaders that came forward. They were local leaders who were committed to redesign. So committed that they would take 3.5 hours out of their commitment or the evening, and many drove as far as an hour each way to participate in the conversations, to sit at the table with total strangers and talk about how they can better serve their public. We all serve the same people. We should start working together. It's not about me, it's about we. And so we'll have a lot more to say about that as we go. We're trying to maximize our taxpayers' dollars and provide the best services we can for our Minnesotans. And so what I'd like to do now is have Peter Hutchinson from the Bush Foundation and Carlene Rhodes of the St. Paul and Minnesota Community Foundations come forward and share their interest in these efforts.
Ms. Rhodes and Mr. Hutchinson, welcome.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself on the tape so that...
I'm Carlene Rhodes, President and CEO of the St. Paul Foundation and Minnesota Community Foundation.
And I'm Peter Hutchinson, the President of the Bush Foundation.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thank you for having us here this morning. Our job is very brief, which is to just provide a little context about why we would be interested in supporting this sort of work and a little bit about our involvement. At the Bush Foundation, we began this work back in 2009 as the recession was taking hold and people like Tom Gillespie and Tom Stinson were rampaging around introducing us to the concept of the new normal. The sort of perpetual challenge that we're going to be facing, all of us in this state, in adjusting to a world in which we're all getting older, the challenges are getting greater, and the money's not growing as fast as it used to. We have now, through our joint efforts, sponsored 3 different series of community sessions around this state and 3 separate statewide polls to try to test and understand where the public is on the question of redesign. And the one message that I bring to you from that research is the public is there. The public, in some very deep ways, understands the challenges we face in this state and has a very high expectation of all of us to be willing to challenge and rethink the way we've done things in the past. For example, in 2010 and 11, we hosted 36 community meetings around the state focused specifically on the state budget. And the big theme that came out of those 36 sessions was about redesign. It was about really rethinking and reforming the way we deliver public services, because the people of Minnesota hold public services dear. They understand the importance of public service, but they also understand in this new reality we're going to have to think different. This was confirmed by a statewide poll that we did at that same time, in which overwhelming majorities of Minnesotans made it crystal clear that they really do believe we need to figure out how to get more for our money. Then last summer, we hosted three fairly good-sized community sessions. This is just around the time of the shutdown, in which we actually challenged citizens to balance the budget. And as in all of these sessions, these are random groups of citizens, mostly assembled because of their diversity, not because of their agreement. And we put people in tables in which they wouldn't naturally necessarily show up, and provided them with the same challenge you all faced. How do you put this budget together in a way that would make some sense? And again, overwhelmingly, people said that redesign reform would need to be a central part of any long-term solution to the financial challenges we face. Similarly, a statewide poll at the same time confirmed that people of Minnesota do expect that redesign reform will need to be part of any long-term agenda for figuring out a way to sustain vital public services. And then naturally, when we were asked whether or not we would be interested in supporting these local government innovative sessions, absolutely the answer had to be yes, because we'd already seen twice the ways in which people of Minnesota were more than willing to come together to explore the possibilities. And so we were very pleased to have the opportunity to be supportive of these sessions. You'll hear a lot more about those in just a minute. What I want you to know is this fall we commissioned a third statewide poll just to keep checking on the pulse of the people of Minnesota. And three things stand out from this most recent poll, which we've not yet released. The first is that by 3-to-1 margin, people believe the quality of life in Minnesota is going down. And this clearly is a reflection of the effects, of the long-term effects of the recession that we've been facing. Secondly, people in Minnesota are, if asked about whether it's better to balance the budget through tax increases or spending cuts, 55% of people are willing to reduce spending. And this is a change over the last couple of years, and again, I think reflects the financial circumstances that people are experiencing in our state. And finally, reconfirming by overwhelming margins, people believe in the face of the challenges we face, redesign and reform have got to be a central part of the solution, because it's the only way that you can actually end up preserving the quality of the public services that people want and expect with the resources that people actually expect to have available. So again, message I bring to you in support of what you're about to hear from these local government officials is that redesign is, for people in Minnesota, a central part of the solution. And we're so encouraged because the local government officials are clearly ready and willing to rise to that occasion. So let me turn it over to Carlene to give you a little more background about our work together as foundation.
Thanks, Peter, and thank you, Representative Lanning, for allowing us to be with you today. As Carol has mentioned, five foundations got together and worked to figure out if there's a role we could play in the redesign conversation that seemed needed in the state. This is your purview, but was there a role that we could play as independent foundations? And what we did is basically, you're maybe familiar with our reports that came out in 2009, Minnesota's Bottom Line. What we did is surveyed the country and found some redesign ideas that had worked in other places, and we put them out in a report in 2009. Last year, we updated that and called that report Beyond the Bottom Line, and there were 16 redesigns in that report, similarly assembled as spark plugs for you, ideas that you might pursue, you might think about them, you might create your own version. These reports are a real important illustration for us of the types of innovative thinking that is required and that is happening and that we can accomplish too. But just to be really clear, our goal isn't to say that those ideas and those reports are ones we should enact, that we should move forward with them. They're meant to stimulate our thinking. We may see some things that look close to something that would work, but we need to put our Minnesota imprint on those ideas. Our goal was to really help state and other local officials figure out if they could imagine another way of doing things. Could we basically get more services, maybe for less money, higher quality services for the same money that's available? So we basically in the process had three principles that we believe can serve as a measuring stick for evaluating redesign ideas. The first is really simple. We need to make strategic choices. So we brought a lot of ideas forward in those reports. Other people are bringing them. We think it's really required that we make some hard decisions and decide where can we have the greatest impact. Prioritization, of course, can be really difficult, especially in complicated systems and institutions, but it's essential to lay the groundwork for effective redesign. We'd encourage you to be willing to be open to looking critically at programs. Let go of some that aren't really meeting the needs anymore. Put resources towards programs and designs that you think will actually help Minnesotans accomplish what they need for the future. The second principle is to innovate. It sounds really obvious when you're talking about redesign that we want to innovate, but we really think the challenge before you is to think about how you can look at yesterday's systems that aren't meeting our needs and figure out how they need to become tomorrow's systems. How do we evolve to have different solutions? Third principle for effective redesign, in our opinion, is to focus on outcomes. Redesign means thinking differently about how Minnesota's public services are delivered, but it doesn't mean sacrificing outcomes in the process. You know, along the lines of the kinds of meetings Peter and the Bush Foundation had around the state, we're hearing that people still want quality services. They still want a high-quality Minnesota, and they do believe it can be done by thinking afresh of how we would use resources that we have. Is the goal to ensure timely road maintenance or effective delivery of health and wellness, or is it something else entirely? But focusing on the outcome as you think about it, we think would be a smart thing to do. We hope these three principles are helpful to you in the work ahead as you consider different ideas that will come forward from the local government innovation forums and as you evaluate other redesign ideas that undoubtedly will percolate forward. I want to leave just two more thoughts with you, essential principles, again, that we think might be outcomes that you'd actually want to look for. First, we believe that redesign must offer significant long-term cost savings. We understand that sometimes the design process or early implementation will cost you some money. You need to retrain staff, you need to develop some systems, but the long-term cost savings should really be the focus of the effort. And the second outcome that we'd encourage you to consider and to expect is that we really can have sustained and improved public service, whether it's Clear Lakes or keeping our top-notch educational system. The basic essence of these services can be maintained as we undertake redesign. So I think a lot of the examples that were heard at the local government innovation forums live up to the principles and achieve outcomes. And I'm pleased to have been part of the process that brought some of these ideas forward to all of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks to both of your foundations for your support and work in this arena. Clearly, our success depends upon citizen involvement, the private sector, as well as all of us in the public sector, to pay attention to this. Mr. Hutchinson, I was wondering if you could supply us with the survey results. Sure. That you quoted, and do you have it on a longitudinal from the early the results on the first one versus the second?
We do, and we'll supply you with all three.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler. Representative Kahn, do you have a question?
Yes, I have a question, and I could make this as a question for everyone who speaks at this point. And this, we're all talking about how important the outcomes of this are. And do any of you have any quantitative measures of outcomes? And specifically, I'd like to know, let me give a simple example, which we all believe is true, but let's say that if you start supplying school breakfasts to a school where there are kids in need of school breakfast, their academic improvement is going to improve, and that's going to stay improved over the years. Is there any before, during, and after measurement to show that that's true?
Ms. Rhodes or Mr. Hutchinson?
And with all of the kinds of things you do. Have you instituted measurements into any of this?
I do think that both of the reports that we produced, Minnesota's bottom line and beyond the bottom line, demonstrated for you some outcomes that other states had experienced when they implemented the idea. So I don't know if they will tie to, but so they may give you, there are definitely measures in there. So for example, in one state, they spent more money on more chemical dependency treatment, how much they saved in their correction system. So those are examples. But the other people who are working on redesign here may have some of the metrics you're looking for.
Well, I know that I believe it's in the state of Iowa that they have done a system of results-based budgeting where they look specifically at their budgets and then they look specifically at the results afterwards. And they have a set of software that enables them to definitely link the result. And, you know, sometimes it's not positive. You can put a lot of money into something and it stays the same or goes down for various reasons. And they've specifically traced that in their budgeting, and then they're tracing it not so much in abstract things, but in, the money that they need for that activity in the future, the kind of appropriation requests and, showing money saved like in a decline in institutionalization or something like that.
Mr. Hutchinson?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Kahn, that's entirely true about Iowa. And an even better example is the state of Washington. And I'd encourage you to go look at the Washington State Policy Institute's work, specifically looking at the question, if we put a dollar in over here, what do we get back over here? And they've done extensive analysis of dozens and dozens and dozens of programs and have developed a very concrete methodology for doing this going forward. And I can report to you that in the case of our foundation, we're using that methodology to evaluate program proposals that are coming to us in the public sector because we think it's very, very rigorous, very disciplined, and really gives us a way to evaluate which programs are producing better outcomes for the money and which ones are not, and is helping us make our decisions, and it's been very successful in the state of Washington.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn,
I'm more interested in us using it in our decision-making process than in somebody giving advice to us and using it in their decision-making process.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn. I can just say that in our past discussions, the Redesign Caucus has heard a lot of evidence-based issues, but we also supported legislation within the policy committees that are really focused that way. I can just say in Health and Human Services, one of the first bills that we supported was switching the accountability for counties to performance outcomes rather than process kind of measures and those sorts of things. And I think all of our policy committees in their subject area are spending more time doing that now. We do have a lot of people to present, so we're going to try and see if we can have kind of a more general question and answer period at the end. But I'd like to now introduce the heads of our big three local government associations, our partners in delivering services throughout the state of Minnesota, and that's Bob Meeks of the Minnesota School Boards Association, Jim Miller, the Executive Director of the League of Minnesota Cities, and Jeff Spartz of the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Welcome, and we'd ask each of you to introduce yourself. We're on TV today, so folks at home like to know who's before us.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Meeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota School Board Association. It's kind of nice to be back for 25 years. I represent the School Board Association up here as intergovernmental relations team and spent a few hours in this chair before, so thank you for having us, and I'll take a few minutes and turn it over to my colleagues. I want to offer some of the context of redesign from a local government perspective. Minnesota is the home of 87 counties, 854 cities, 334 public school districts, and 3 intermediate districts, and a whole pile of townships. So that gives us kind of a unique point of view when we look at redesign. We're faced with the implementation for many state and federal programs and public services, and we're the front line of delivering services. So we're always thinking about how to deliver public services better and more efficiently. how to move from the confines of counting inputs and tracking processes to the benefits of focusing on outcomes. And Representative Kahn, as an example, in the school districts at least, the cost and spending levels are what we can look at. Now, we certainly have test results. You all know how much testing we do of students. So we have a general idea of how students are doing based on what we're doing. We have student attendance, which is becoming more and more important as we move forward. We have staff retention, which has become an issue. We have the district report card, which is issued every year as a matter of transparency. And then we have something that a group I serve on and a number of legislators and others from, it's called the P20 group, pre-K through 20. So it's your early childhood all the way through your post-secondary, grad level. And we are in the process of producing something called SLEDS, the Student Longitudinal Educational Data Systems, that's going to track, be able to track a child from when they get into our system at whatever level, all the way through work, actually. So we're going to have the ability to look at the outcomes. Now, as we face the challenge of the new normal that you've all heard about, a declining tax base, an aging population, and an increased demand for public services, our interest in providing public services in new, better ways as saved dollars is amplified. Just last month, local government innovation forums were underway. 124 districts had referendums, and 79% were successful in passing. That's very good. I'm worried about the 21% that weren't. The Stillwaters, the North Branches, the others that could be named. You know the stories of the levies and the taxes and the votes, the stories that often make the newspapers. But what we may not hear as often are stories of innovation, of the local government leaders who have been willing to roll up their sleeves, work together, and find new ways to deliver our state's essential services. That's the story we're here to share with you today. For myself, my colleagues at the table here with me, public service redesign has two essential outcomes. First, we have to save taxpayer dollars. We know that. We know that it's getting harder and harder to find the dollar to fund what's needed. And second, we need to sustain and improve outcomes, what Representative Kahn was leading on to. We know full well that programs that may have made sense 30 years ago can no longer fit the needs of our constituents. Or the intent of programs could still be noble, but the process to achieve those outcomes may not make sense today. That's what sustaining or improving outcomes means to us, making sure that our constituents are getting the outcomes they expect from our local government: safe streets, quality schools, access to housing and health care for needy residents, and much more, must be an integral part of redesign at the local level. And we suggest that these same outcomes guide your state-level redesign work. We know it's what the public wants. You just heard the Bush Foundation talk about their studies. I'm pleased to be before you today to say that as local units of government, we understand the need for thoughtful, comprehensive redesign. And our members are already well ahead of the curve, finding alternative paths, new partnerships, and optimal technologies to help our cities, counties, and schools do their jobs even better. Let me just break from my prepared testimony just for a minute and give you a couple of local stories. I now live in St. Peter. That's where our office is. So I know what the St. Peter School District is doing. I follow it very closely. They are in the process of following what 25 districts did out in southwestern Minnesota. They came together, they looked at what they had to work with, and they put a new program together. And by the way, sometimes you talk about state barriers. Out there, they had to go so far as to come to the state to get permission to put their calendars together, something that you would think a local school board could do on its own, but it can't. So those 25 districts, now down to 23, I believe, two dropped out, and that's the way it was built. If it wasn't working for you, get out. St. Peter's following that. They have six districts, and they're trying to zero in our part of the state. Agriculture is very big. The whole area around St. Peter, Nicollet, Le Sueur, Montgomery Lonsdale, Cleveland, and I can't remember, St. Clair and Lake Crystal are all districts that have a great need for more agricultural education. So they're trying to infuse agricultural education into the standards that we have to meet. Also, the St. Peter School Board, the St. Peter City Council, and the Nicollet County Commissioners have a regularly scheduled meeting where they get together, and they don't get together for coffee. They get together to work. And they're looking at such things as we have buses that set quiet, other than in the morning and the evening when we're picking up students or taking students home. Is there a need or a way we can use those buses for other transportation? We have cafeterias. Now, can we use those with jail and others? We also have six libraries in St. Peter. We have the Gustavus. We have the three schools, the elementary, the intermediate, or the middle school and the high school. We have the city, and I believe the state hospital has one. So how can we form a more joint effort in those areas? That's what local redesign is. Find out how to do better what we're doing so that our citizens and our students have better outcomes. And with that, I'll be happy to take questions later, but I'll turn to my good friend, Mr. Miller.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Miller, and I'm the executive director of the League of Minnesota Cities. And I first of all want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members for taking the time today to listen to the story that you're going to hear. As you've already heard, and as we all firmly believe, this is an incredibly important story, and we're pleased to be here to share it with you today. I also would be remiss if I didn't thank Representatives McFarland and Loeffler for their leadership in this effort. I'll have to admit, when I first heard that this was going to happen, I won't say I was cynical, but I will say I was skeptical about what would happen, and I couldn't have been more wrong. I think what has transpired over the last few weeks has been truly, truly amazing, and I hope that we're able in some small way to convey that to you today. I've had the privilege of serving as the executive director of the League of Minnesota Cities for almost 20 years, and before that I worked for seven different municipalities for over 20 years. So I've been around local government now for 40-some years. And I can honestly tell you the one common theme that I see, regardless of time or location, is that the people that are on the ground, much as you take your jobs the way you do, but the people in our cities, our counties, and our school districts are completely and irrevocably committed to trying to make their communities a better place. And I say that even in these very, very difficult financial times that they are experiencing. If anything, what I see and what I hear is that the resolve is even greater than it ever has been before. Like Bob, they prepared 25 pages of notes for me that I'm supposed to read to you, but I'm going to save that because I'm not very good at reading testimony, and I'm going to try and make just three points that I hope are cogent and relevant to what we're talking about today. First, I want to share with you an effort that the League of Minnesota Cities has undertaken and is in the process of completing, that is somewhat parallel to the work that has been the subject of the hearing today. But we commissioned 12 forums, I'll call them, this past year in communities around the state where we wanted to hear from citizens. We did not invite the local government officials. We wanted to hear from the people in those communities, and we went to where they were. So we had meetings at churches, at VFW, at service clubs. We went anywhere where we thought we could get a cross-section of people by the time we concluded our 12 forums around the state. In each of those forums, we had four meetings with the citizens in those communities. And the purpose of those meetings was really threefold. It was to find out what people really valued in terms of services in their community, what they could live with and what they could not live, what they were not willing to live without, who they thought ought to be providing those services, and then how these services ought to be paid for. Again, we had no ulterior motive. This wasn't anything to do with local government aid. We weren't trying to build a case to come back and visit you in January or February and say we need more local government aid. That'll happen anyway. But we really wanted to understand what people in our communities were thinking about so that our local officials had a better understanding of what had to happen. What we heard really was, and we're not in a position to release those findings yet. We will be doing that around the first of the year, I hope. But let me give you just a general sense of what we heard from citizens. There is a resounding just overwhelming belief in our communities around the state that much of what they are receiving right now continues to be important, whether that's police service or whether it's library service. Again, there's a tremendous attachment to those services, an attachment in the sense of these services contribute to the quality of life in those communities. That said, citizens are also, I think, willing to say, we know that our local government officials need to rethink how services are delivered. We know that they need to start talking to the elected officials at the county and at the school district, and we need to figure out better ways of providing services. It may no longer make sense to have police services that are more costly if the only real result of that is that the identification on the squad car is that of my home community. So I think there's a receptivity on the part of citizens to look for change, and I think there is a willingness on their part to do more at the local level, and again, not to always be looking to the state to solve their problems. What we heard in the six innovation forums that is the subject of today's hearing was, again, a reaffirmation of what I intuitively knew and suspected, but it was really reassuring, and that is that city officials are up to the task, and county officials and school district officials are as well. I did not hear anything from any of these officials about, well, you know, this is really an unfortunate situation, and we shouldn't be in this condition, and if we only wait for a year or two, things are going to go back to the way they were before. That may have been the sentiment 10 years ago. It no longer is, I can assure you, and local government officials, whether they're school, city, or county, take this very, very seriously, and they're looking for ways to change. I don't know that this is necessarily conclusive evidence, but I would point to the recent report that came out a week or so ago about levies for 2012. And if you saw that report, as I'm sure you did, you noticed that local government levies are estimated to go up by no more than 1.2% in 2012 compared to 2011. That's the preliminary number, and of course that could come down once all of the truth and taxation hearings are held. And I say that only to demonstrate that local government officials, again, and that 1.2% represents city, county, and school districts collectively, take the job very, very responsibly. They're up for the task, they're willing to be partners with you, and they're looking forward to the challenges that our current new normal has created. The very last thing I'll share with you is just to let you know that the three of us here, more importantly, the organizations that we represent, have had a relatively long history, at least over the last going on a decade, I would say, of working together and trying to do a better job of modeling collaboration and innovation for our members, and we will continue to do that. We, for example, are currently providing some legal services for the School Boards Association. AMC and the League have an agreement to provide technology services, so we're looking at not only broadcasting the message to our members, but trying to live it as well. Again, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. Again, I firmly believe this is incredibly important, and I want to applaud you for taking the time to hear our story today. With that, I'll turn it over to Jeff Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jeff Sparks. I am the executive director.
Excuse me.
This is not a question. I just want to make a comment about Jeff Sparks before he speaks so that people know how they should listen to him. We have kids who have lived 20 years in Eugene, Oregon, and Jeff, before he came to this job, was the county executive in Lane County, headquartered in Eugene, Oregon. And he gave us a list of restaurants which are far superior than we'd ever had before. And I'll have you know, Jeff, at Thanksgiving, we just ate at Sweet Basil Thai restaurant again, and it was out of sight as before. So I trust his judgment implicitly in anything that he may tell us.
I'm glad I was able to do something of value for you. I'm Jeff Sparks, the executive director of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I briefly want to talk about a few points on the components of successful redesign efforts. Redesign is a goal that we all have but it can be remarkably difficult to achieve. The Association of Counties has been working on this for 8 years, and in many respects, we are still taking the first steps towards successful redesign. We think some of the things that are required for successful redesign are, among others, openness to looking beyond boundaries. Minnesota has several thousand local government entities. These were all created, you know, a century or more ago, and under far different circumstances in terms of transportation, communication, technologies, and the concept of what government was supposed to do. We're going to have to be very thoughtful about how we look at these units in the future and to figure out how they best operate and under what circumstances they should operate. Another key point is ongoing communication. We have these dialogues with you. You have dialogues internally. We talk about redesign, but what also is very important is that those ideas get filtered down and repeated both to the employees who are going to be responsible for doing the work of redesign and that the constituencies hear about this frequently. We all think we may have talked about it enough, but my communications guru is a gentleman named Vincent Convello out of New Jersey, and he said you can never really talk about the key concepts too much. I mean, you may be bored to tears with the amount of talk we have internally, but that's necessary so that it engages the public and the employees. When I was in graduate school, I was assigned a task of looking at oil companies and trying to figure out which oil companies were most successful at finding oil and what the key factors may have been. And my team looked at it and looked at it, and we finally concluded we didn't show that it was causal, but we found there was a very strong correlation between how much the boards of directors talked about finding oil and how much oil the companies actually found. So I think it's important what the leadership talks about, and if they talk about it enough, eventually it filters down to the people who need to do the work. We need to have a culture of innovation. We're working hard to develop a culture of innovation, but government systems, because of their need for equity and openness, I think sometimes find it harder to innovate than it is in the private sector. I mean, I've had experience. I did not work for 3M Corporation, but I had the opportunity to work with them on a number of issues, and I found they had a very interesting culture, and that culture was driven, and we have to do the same thing ourselves. It was driven by their ability to embrace failure. I'm going to say that again. It was driven by their ability to embrace failure. For every two or perhaps three products 3M brings to market successfully, they have seven or eight fairly significant product development failures. Yet the company has learned to analyze failures and to learn from those failures, and they don't punish the people who make the failures. They learn and they try again until they get better results. And you're all personally familiar with their most famous product failure of all time. They attempted to develop this industrial solvent. You now call its successor product Post-it Notes. I mean, a stunning success that came out of failure. And we have to be able to do the same things ourselves here in state government and local government, because when we attempt to innovate, there will be failures. But if we start pointing fingers and punishing the people who are involved in the failures, I assure you, they are as smart as white rats in a laboratory maze. They figure out where the rewards are, they figure out where the punishments are, and they go for the rewards and they avoid the punishments. And if the result of failure is punishment, they won't want to play anymore. So, I mean, and somehow we're going to have to rise above the fact that the media will love to feast on the failures as they occur, and we have to embrace that, and we have to say this is part of improving our state and local government systems. We have to tolerate that failure. And one other thing I want to say is a remark from Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE Corporation, who once observed that if you look outside of your organization and you see cycle times that are faster than you see inside your organization, you may be looking at the beginning of your own end. And unfortunately, in government, cycle times are slow. We have to figure out how to speed them up without losing equity and without losing the openness that we're required to give. But if we can embrace these values and preach them and operationalize them, we will have one of the key components we need to successful innovation. And finally, I just want to thank the committee for having looked favorably on our proposed MAGIC Act, Minnesota Accountable Government Innovation and Collaboration Act, and passing it along. It has passed the Senate with a favorable vote, and it now sits in House Ways and Means Committee for its last committee hearing, which we hope can occur early next year. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for having given us the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. Just hold on a moment, if you both, or all three of you would, just a moment. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming and for the good work that's being done. I'm encouraged, and at the same time, I got to be honest, I'm frankly kind of frustrated. I look back at the 1995 Within Our Means report that Governor Carlson commissioned, and I'll just read you some of the headings from almost now 17 years ago, where it says very specifically that the year 2010 is the year at which we flip demographically. And we cannot expect to do the same things that we were doing. And so for 15, 17 years now, it feels to me like we've known what needed to be done, and yet here we are, and I hear comments that we've come together to explore the possibilities, and we're having a redesign conversation, and we are going to stimulate our thinking. We need to do a better job of modeling. We don't really measure outcomes. These are the first steps. There's a new openness. We're working hard to develop. And here were the recommendations from back in 1995 that we need to change the types, levels, and delivery of service. We should target the eligibility for government services, redefine standards, control input costs, and invest in technology, target government infrastructure investments, define the activities that are crucial to the future well-being of the state, build more flexibility into programs and requirements at all levels of government, focus on the most cost-effective approaches, contain costs of government operations and programs. And so I guess my question, I'll ask it as a question because I don't want to be overly critical on us, but apart from just flat-out not funding, from a state perspective, outside of just not funding what you're doing, how do we catalyze this and make it real so that we're not coming back 12 years from now with your organizations browbeating us about our lack of funding and your need to increase local taxes to compensate for our lack of funding? What do we do, and how do we make this real so we're not doing this 5-10 years from now?
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, I greatly appreciate your comments, and it actually reminds me of a point I had hoped to make, and when you speak extemporaneously, you don't always get everything in that you wish to. It's important. I think the committee understands, but it really is an important point for everyone here to recognize that what we're talking about really isn't anything new. It isn't like we woke up sometime this summer and said, gee, maybe we ought to start talking to each other and figure out how we can provide services better. This has been going on for years and years. We've documented, I can't tell you how many, but at the League we document every example that we can think of or find. And there are literally thousands of examples where cities, counties, and schools have collaborated and cooperated. Is it enough? The answer is no. And to your question of how do we resolve this so that going forward we're not coming back and having this conversation 10 years from now, I don't know that there is any one thing. I do think, and it's an overworked term, but the partnership that has to exist between the state and local governments has eroded significantly, at least from our perspective and perhaps from yours. I don't know what the answer entirely is to do that, but I can give you one non-fiscal related issue that I think would be helpful and get to your point. Every year the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm sure my counterparts do the same thing, but we are asked by the legislature, regardless of who happens to be the majority, we're asked by the legislature to come and bring to you a list of mandates that, if you were to relieve, would have an impact not only on our ability to control costs, but maybe on our ability to do more creative problem solving. And I think that request is always made in good faith. I really do. I don't think it's disingenuous in the least. But I can tell you that year after year after year after year after year, what happens is at the end of the session, not much changes. And I think if we're going to really be able to be as effective as we can be in redesigning and reinventing government at the local level, part of it's going to have to be to give local government officials the flexibility to make decisions at the local level. We recognize that we are creatures of the state, cities are, that you create cities. We're not equal partners. But I don't think it can be paternalism either. I think it has to be partnership, and that's one thing that I would argue strongly for going forward.
Mr. Meeks?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, briefly, in 1960, I was a seventh grader in Walker High School, and that is the year of the last force consolidation, last court force consolidation in Minnesota. Hackensack was forced to come to Walker. And let me tell you, it's a lot better and a lot easier if parties do it voluntarily than if the courts or you or others force them to. And if you want to be a general, you got to have troops. And sometimes the hardest people to convince that you need change is the citizens. It's not the elected officials. They look at the books, they look at the program, they look at the test scores, they look at the levies or whatever it may be. But it's that person that lives down the block that really, I graduated from Walker High School and it was fine when I was there and it's fine now. It's the one down the road that's having a problem, not mine. So when you try to do some of this, when you're going to make changes, you got to have the troops with you. And that's difficult. It takes time. Now, has it taken too long yet? But I think the new normal, as we're all using that terminology now, plays. I think we've got it. I think you heard it earlier. I think it's sunk in, and I think it's gotten down to the citizen, as the Bush Foundation survey is starting to show. So I would look back at, we had 400 districts back then, I believe, Representative Downey. I think we have 334 now, so there are changes going on. I do know that there's more and more districts are cooperating not only through their service co-ops, which also work with cities and counties as one way of doing it, but also individually. So give us a chance. Give us a little time. Senator Merriam, when he was chair of the Senate Finance Committee, always used to say, Meeks, why does it cost me money for you to save money? Well, the easy answer was is that if I can take a little bit of bacon home, and I'm going to ask my people to make a tough decision, having that little bit of bacon just kind of greases the griddle a little bit. So it's something I would ask you to think of down the road is some built-in incentives for districts and cities and schools and townships that do things a little bit different. I know the money's tight, but sometimes you only spend a buck once, but it's well spent.
Mr. Sparks, did you wish to respond?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey. I think, you know, if you look back in our history in this country, we were founded on the principles of limited government, and there's always been a historical concern about government changing things, doing things differently. And the best example I can think of, if you go back to 70 years ago today, this very day, you probably had only 30 or 40% of the population who seriously thought we should get involved in that European war. 2 days later, about 98% of the public was in favor of getting involved in that war because of the events that happened in 48 hours that transformed the thinking. I think from 1995 until we started seeing the serious chronic budget deficits, the public was not really engaged in that. But I think in the last couple of years, the public has now gotten engaged and they're starting to understand that this is not just a cyclical problem, this is a permanent structural problem, and we have to start doing things differently to work our way out of it. And I think the public is there now, and opportunities will now present themselves much more rapidly.
Representative Simon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One of the debates we have around here a lot is whether the issue is really that we should be doing things better, more quickly, more efficiently, or should we just be doing fewer things. And so I want to talk to Mr. Miller in particular, but to some extent maybe all of you can comment. When you talked about the meetings that you convened where you talked to real people, not administrators, not people who work for governments, but actual citizens, you mentioned some of the things that they did like libraries and other services. Were there any things that they didn't like? Were there things, were there instances where they said that there were services that were provided that they simply thought shouldn't be provided or that someone else could provide better.
Mr. Miller?
Chair, Representative Sands, again, we're intentionally not releasing the results of that work until the beginning of the year or around there, so I'm going to answer your question very generally. I would say one of the things that surprised me a little bit, though, in those conversations is that for virtually every service, even for services that people themselves admitted they didn't use, they recognize the role that that played in providing quality of life in their community. I think there is less receptivity to doing without than there is to finding new ways of providing those services and doing them in a more cost-effective way. But again, I realize that's kind of a general answer to your question, but it's about all I can give you right now.
Mr. Chairman, could I take a shot at that quick one?
Okay, please. We'd like to keep moving here.
It better if you're, you know, the public school's a little bit different. We have to educate. Everybody comes to our doors. Can't say you can't come in. You can. So in that case, I think better. But fewer districts is evident of where we've been, and I think online learning, you want to look at something that's going to change education. Look in that direction because that's already coming down the road, and that will have a major impact. So we will do fewer and better there, I believe. Thank you, sir.
Representative Kahn?
Yes.
And we're going to move on.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, if I put together a set of bills based on the results of the Arnie Carlson's report, will you guarantee to co-author them?
Representative Downey, you don't have to answer that.
Why?
Chairman, Representative Kahn, there is a high likelihood that I would support bills that specifically implemented those recommendations.
Oh,
so, yes, I welcome the opportunity.
Okay. We'll...
Let me... that.
Why does everyone else shiver?
I'm not going to ask this question, but I do want to make a point to all three of the folks that were before us here. The key question before us is, what is the role of the state in supporting or helping you achieve what you're trying to achieve by way of redesign? Obviously, does this all happen naturally? The state doesn't need to do anything. Do we need to provide some incentives? Or are there some things maybe that we need to mandate? Bad word. I don't like the word mandate, but I guess as you folks continue to work on this, and I commend you for the work that you're doing, please keep in mind what is it that we can or need to consider doing to help this process along. And certainly, Mr. Miller, your point about mandates, unnecessary, unfunded mandates, is clearly one of the things that I know you will come back to us with. But please keep that in mind. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank also the executive directors of the Big Three. I don't know too many times that they all come up in force, and I think there's a strong message there. Now, before we go any further, I wanted to introduce to you Laura LaCroix DeLune, who is the project manager. We were able to get her services because of the support of the foundations, and we were very, very lucky. And I thought that she could maybe go over an overview of what one of these sessions looked like and what we were looking for. So.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the community, thank you for having me here this morning. I'll talk quickly to try to keep us on schedule, but I wanted to just provide an overview for those of you who weren't able to join us. I know a few of you had been with us at some of the meetings, and thank you for that. The overview of the meeting is we did this in support with In Commons, which is an effort being incubated by the Bush Foundation to encourage courageous conversations across the state of Minnesota. In Minnesota, we're not so good at saying the tough things that often need to be said to one another, and so these meetings were designed to really help build relationships across governmental jurisdictions and to really create and foster environments where collaboration can happen, innovation and redesign can happen. We utilized the new normal as kind of a framework for the event, for the evening, and then we really spent a lot of time engaging folks in conversation with another. We began with dinner, broke bread together, shared a meal together. So often we don't take the time to get to know our colleagues. We sit down in meetings and we know so little about them on a personal level. And yet those are the kinds of information, that's kind of information we need to know about one another to better understand how somebody comes to the table and what's behind their ideas. So these conversations, these focused conversations, we're asking local government leaders to dream big. What are all the many different ideas they have around redesign of public services and the structure of government itself? Do we need all of the cities? Do we need all of our school districts? Do we need all of our counties? So asking them to think both services and structure, thinking big, looking at what are the barriers and obstacles at the local level and at the state level, and then what are the desired outcomes? So what is it that we actually want to achieve through public service delivery, and how can we move in that, how can we move in that direction? So that is the focus of that. In your packet, you should have this graphic here, and Representative McFarland asked me to spend a little bit of time talking about this because this is really the theory that supported these meetings. And this is a core theory of systems change model. And it identifies the fact that in order to make systems change in policy and public service delivery, it starts with quality relationships. It is absolutely essential that we are in a position where we can debate and dialogue with one another in meaningful ways. And quality relationships means we can disagree, we can agree, we can figure out where each other is coming from to better understand one's position. Far too often, when we're in a dialogue with somebody or in a conversation with somebody, we turn on that editor and we begin to assume that we understand somebody's point of view, and we stop listening to what people have to say. So we absolutely need to begin to have quality relationships, not only at the local level, but as we heard even in this hearing, it's essential that we begin to build strong, meaningful relationships with elected officials across the state. Once you have those strong relationships, you move to this quality collective thinking. And that is what was really energizing to folks around the state, is that they got to a point in these focused conversations where they had some agreement around public service delivery or the structures that could be redesigned. They had a chance to debate with each other. They had a chance to disagree with each other and then come to agreement. It was there then that they were able to articulate how they could move to quality action that would lead to the quality results for the state of Minnesota. This is a reinforcing loop. This is the process it takes to make really good sound systems change and policy change, and it all begins with all of you and all of our local elected officials across the state. And it's absolutely essential that we never forget that it's the people that make the decisions, that create the systems, that create the change. So that is what was behind our local events. We will have a report that is delivered in January, and it's my understanding now that we'll turn it over to folks to give you highlights of what we heard.
Thank you. Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll ask the same question of, if I could. Sorry to keep you from leaving. So it seems to me that the cycle that you described there in a cross-jurisdictional political environment, that is very much a multi-year proposition as legislative bodies and local councils and boards change, that's a long haul. And so it seems to me, and my previous question similar to that, it seems to me that the time to be doing that was maybe the last 10 years as compared to the next 10 years. And so my question for you, your professional judgment, is there a way to accelerate the time frame so that we can move from whiteboarding and brainstorming and relationship building to real bills and real legislation and real shared services and real outcomes for taxpayers? Because my sense is that for the last 5 years, at least the last three that I've been here, that the fundamental debate has been the state is starving us, so now we have to raise taxes, and so we'll blame the state for our tax increases, and that doesn't seem to be really fertile ground for super great collaboration, and it feels to me that we're locked into this debate here that's focused on that as compared to collaboration and sharing and all of these other things. So how do we get past the political hurdles that we face today and accelerate that time frame so we're not doing the same thing for the next 10 years?
Right. Ms. LaCroix, Dillon.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Downing. I'm representing my own organization here, not all of our partners. It really does come back to this for me. We will not accelerate action unless we have some agreement about where we're going, what are the results we want for the state, and if we can't trust one another and understand that we have each other's backs, that we all come with our own ideas about how to make change, but we have to agree upon collective action. And that is the piece. So it doesn't have to take forever, but it does take constant nurturing and constant attention to the relationships, to that collective action that leads you to the results and the outcomes. So you can accelerate that as quickly as you want, but it absolutely requires us to be in strong relationship with each other as we make these tough decisions.
Okay, we need to move on.
Yeah.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now is probably the best part of the whole hearing is being able to hear from some of the participants in the sessions. And so today we have with us that they've come forward, Tony Murphy from Beltrami County, Marion Clennon of the Austin City Council, and Kevin Donovan from the Monomede High School Board.
Welcome, and please identify yourself for everyone. And I don't know who's going first. You decide your order.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kevin Donovan, and I'm with the Monomede High School Board, and I'm a grocer by profession, and in business we need to innovate and adapt or we perish. And so this kind of work is something that I find very intriguing and very fun because it's what I do for my main livelihood. But what I wanted to share was a couple of examples of things that are happening. A lot of this is, I think, happening already organically, but we don't have a system in place necessarily that brings us together in a way that's easy to access these great things that are happening. So in Monomede Schools, we've had a great success recently. We've opened a fab lab, a fabrication lab. It's an offshoot from MIT. Currently, there are 63 of these fab labs around the world. They collaborate together electronically through use of Polycam, and all of the things that are innovated in this in these labs are shared. And it's something kind of like what we're talking about today. And in this process, when we started working with MIT, we collaborated with Century College, found out that they also have a fab lab, and we thought it would be great to be able to offer those same things to a K-12 school district. Currently, there are 63 of these fab labs around the world, 63 of them, 62 of which are in institutions of higher learning, colleges and universities around the world. There is one currently in Matamidi. We are unique in the world of having a fab lab from MIT. Now, we didn't get there by ourselves. We enlisted the aid of community volunteers. Matamidi is fortunate in the sense that we are in the backyard of 3M. I believe we have more retired engineers per square mile than anywhere else in the world. We've used their expertise to come into the schools. We've also used the city has helped provide some support, and we've gotten in funding from the McKnight Foundation and others. So this has been a collaborative effort, very organic. It worked, it came together, and is now operational. And the charter of the Fab Lab is to be open to all the residents in our communities and our cities to be able to use this after hours so that it's something that's available when we get enough staffing to be, it'll be available around the clock. Another example is in White Bear Lake with the local food shelf, where the city is involved with the school district. We serve in the White Bear food shelf. We service the area of the of the school district. And again, when there are things that come up very organically, people work together and collaborate on these efforts. Last night we had a little meeting. There was too much food coming into the food shelf. We need a little space. And so the city of White Bear just so happened to have an extra spot in their public works area. They gave us the space to put some of the non-perishable food in the space for the next couple months until it flows through to clients. So I guess my point in all this is things are happening, but how do we ensure that they continue to happen, and that we, if we have something that we're thinking about, an idea that there's maybe some kind of an electronic clearinghouse or something that we could go to for trying to look at one of our problems or to share what we have with others. I mean, what we have, I think, is some great stuff going on. I'd love to share that more, and it's more random. Currently, you talk to someone at one of these meetings, which is great because there were a lot of great ideas exchanged, but I think there needs to be yet even more in the sense that we have a way of sharing statewide these great initiatives that I think are already happening. We need to continue to work on that, and I think these dinner meetings have been a great catalyst. I've seen some great collaboration in those 3.5-hour sessions, so thank you.
Thank you.
Ms.
Clannan.
Thank you, Representative McFarland, and thank you, Representative Lanning, and members of the committee for having me here today. I am Marion Clennon, a member of the Austin City Council. I've served on the City Council for the past 3 years and have enjoyed working with the city to find ways to provide services better. Locally, we've been looking for ways to collaborate with neighboring cities, counties, to not only cut costs, but to provide services better. We know that we need to have some creativity when it comes to redesigning our systems and really think beyond simple solutions to find new approaches that really work for and benefit everyone involved. By thinking this way and collaborating with the county, we have been able to find new ways to improve our law enforcement services. The city and the county have joint law enforcement center. We have each have our own officers, but we share the same dispatch center and the same office area, and we share half of the building costs. The system not only saves building and other costs, but also allows our law enforcement to do their jobs better. For example, now that our police chief and county sheriff share an office, they're working much more closely together to address cases, patrols, and other work. It's a prime example of how these cost-saving efforts are producing better results for Austin taxpayers on every level. As another example, our fire chief is working with fire departments across the county. He has taken the initiative to work with all of the different departments to take an inventory of all the equipment. This way, they don't duplicate certain equipment and prevent unnecessary spending. Additionally, the different departments will be working with each other. Everyone will know what everyone has and will know what resources to pull when they have an incident. The system will save time and money for all involved. But we understand that not every experiment is successful. For example, the cities of Austin and Albert Lea did experiment with sharing a city finance director. Albert Lea was in the middle of some transitions and didn't have a full-time finance director. To help and condense costs, we offered to share our finance director on a part-time basis. Knowing it would be a stretch for the director, we agreed that we'd check in to see if the system works or not. With the distance and the workload, the system ended up not working, but at least we both tried and were willing to give the system a chance. That's what collaboration is about for us. We both chipped in, and both wanted to see if it would work. And the conversations didn't stop there. Several cities in the area are still exploring joint ventures to see if we can find some opportunities to share resources and serve our constituents better. Yet communication can't just exist between cities, counties, and school districts. We need to have some conversations with the state, too. After all, we have the same end goal, to find collaborations and partnerships that can allow us to continue providing high-quality public services
but more efficiently and at a lower cost. It's essential that we recognize from all of this that we can find ways of cutting costs and still getting the job done. But we've got to keep communicating. If we did more talking together, we might find that we're duplicating services that we really don't need to duplicate. We could learn from one another's successes and failures. In the long run, communicating, collaborating, and trying to find ways to redesign our system in ways that really work and deliver outcomes is going to save our taxpayers money and create better services for those we're elected to serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Murphy. I'm the Beltrami County Administrator. I feel honored to be back before you. I met with you earlier this year, very early in the session, and enjoyed that opportunity to share some of the things that Beltrami County has been doing in the form of outcome-based government. Since that opportunity I had to meet with you, I think I've given outcome-based presentations to 27 organizations in the state this year. In fact, at one point, members of the Beltrami County Board asked me to give a more careful accounting of where I was going these days. Meeting with county boards, meeting with a variety of associations, just to help them understand the basic principles that are involved with outcome-based government. I'm very appreciative for the support of the foundations and them bringing groups together across boundaries to continue those kinds of dialogues. I attended the meeting in Bemidji, of course, and was very grateful to sit across the table from representatives from the city of Baudette or Lake of the Woods County or Manoman School District, talking about how outcome-based government, how innovation needs to be part of our new cultures as we move forward. I think that one of the things that we're learning in Beltrami County, as we continue to work on this principle of outcome-based orientation, is that real redesign requires you to work across boundaries. If you are just working within your own turf or on your own turf or within your own silo, there's a certain amount of incremental improvement that can take place. But it is not disruptive innovation, as defined by Clayton Christensen at Harvard University and other publications. In many cases, even some of the things that we're dabbling with right now in pilot projects throughout the state perhaps could be described as a little bit more incremental innovation, just trying to do more with less, perhaps. But it isn't the kind of disruptive innovation that we will likely need in the future in order to look at new business models. I do believe that to the extent that we can develop opportunities to work across boundaries, to look at those kinds of opportunities would be helpful. I thought it might be helpful if I gave you an example of the kind of dialogue that we had in our little group at this innovation redesign discussion we had in Bemidji. As we were talking about what would be something that we could talk about as far as a disruptive innovation, we noticed that two of the participants in our group felt like if they continued to see declining trends in their revenue, that their small town police departments would likely go away. What will they do? City of Baudette was one example of that. Well, as we talked more about amongst ourselves, we began to realize that the issue is not having enough law enforcement in their county or in their jurisdictions. The issue is really how we deploy with those kinds of benefits. For example, in Beltrami County, we have a sheriff's department, we have police departments in the city of Bemidji and city of Black Duck. We have tribal police departments, well-staffed. We have FBI. We have the Border Patrol. We have the State Patrol. We have DNR conservation officers. If you define law enforcement in terms of someone having a badge and a gun, our problem is not having enough law enforcement. Our problem is that we continue to be locked in our silos and in our philosophies of service delivery. The kind of disruptive innovation that we were talking about in these kinds of gatherings is, what if the silos went away? What if the turf went away? How would we organize law enforcement in Beltrami County? those are the kinds of discussions that I think are going to be needed and should be embraced. In Beltrami County, we have focused primarily to this point on our culture and on defining our outcome measures and defining those things that we need to be accomplishing, our targets. Now the real task for us is execution. Can we execute? One of the things that I would like to request of you again is give us vehicles for execution. I think the MAGIC Act is one of those kinds of vehicles. It gives us a place to land as far as working across boundaries, trying new things within the protections that that provides as a vehicle for hopefully not just incremental innovation, but disruptive innovation. I look forward to working with you as we continue to move forward with these discussions, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks to each of you for your work and the whole redesign effort. And as I indicated to the leaders of your organizations, we need to hear from you as to what the state can or should do to help support your effort, to help you be able to do more of what you'd like to do by way of redesign. So please keep that in mind as you go forward. And Mr. Murphy, I'm not surprised to hear that you've been in high demand. We're very well received here in what you told our committee earlier this year. So thank you and congratulations.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative McFarland.
Yes, I know we're running short on time, and I know people have questions, but I thought I'd wrap up my comments if I could. I just wanted to comment about whether we're talking about creating more efficiencies, redesign, reform, or innovation. It's all an opportunity. And we have people that are committed to working with us. And for some Minnesota leaders, local leaders are willing to make these commitments to advance through redesign. I hope my fellow members will join me in making some level of commitment to thoughtful redesign. And I want to leave with one last thing. Tom Glaspie's presentation, he always says, quotes Wayne Gretzky. And he says, "I skate to where the puck will be, not to where it has been." And I think we have an opportunity in this state now to be where, to go to where the puck is instead of being lagging behind. And I want to really thank the chair for this opportunity to bring this effort forward. I want to thank the big three, the executive directors and their local government representatives, all the foundations in Commons. I'm going to miss somebody, so I apologize if I do. Tom Glaspie. We asked Tom to do a new normal video for us. We asked for 10 minutes. We got 25. Of course, we all know Tom. And but he came live in Eagan, and he held it to 10 minutes, and it was fabulous. It gives everybody the focus on why we need to have these discussions. And so I hope I haven't left anybody out. It was great to work with all of these people, and we're glad we could share it with you. So I'll have it open up to questions, and then you can quit whenever you need to.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Mr. Donovan, just for clarification.
Mr.
Mr. Donovan, when you were talking about your Fab Lab that you were going to open up to citizens, you said that you could do that as soon as you got more staff.
Staff
is... didn't understand that.
Mr. Chair, committee, what I meant by that is... we are in the process of training people that have an interest in this discipline from the community to actually act as kind of the project lead, to be on site to help people through this equipment in this Fab Lab. Is lasers and 3D printers and milling machines, all controlled by computers. And I, at a weak moment, decided to take the class myself, and I found out that the rigor that we ask of our students is much beyond my capacity. It's very hard work, but what we need to do is train these people, and they would be volunteers, not paid staff. They would be volunteers that would help facilitate the Fab Lab at times when the school is not in session.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question is for Representative McFarland.
Okay.
Thank
okay.
you. I guess what I wanted to explore just a little bit, I know we got short on time here, but is where do we go from here? is, where does your committee go from here? And also, I was hoping to hear from some business leaders, perhaps. Everybody that you had that gave reflections of the regional meetings were government people, and I think what we need to do is look at the private sector, who have really made this this transition over the years in reforming, and wanted to know what kind of participation are you getting with business leaders in this process.
Well, you have to Representative Chair McFarland. And Representative Leidiger, you have to remember this was an initiative for local governments and the big three organizations. And we had many people who wanted to participate. Higher ed wanted to participate, all kinds. But we had to start somewhere where we could put our arms around it and actually do something. We also think that as we move forward, we hope that we kind of did a train-the-trainer model so that in these different, the people that attended these meetings can get the people that work for them or the providers of services within their organizations, that they can get them to talking, because sometimes I think it's better for it to come from the grassroots and up. But there are many opportunities out there. We are the House Redesign Caucus. Everybody here is a member. We always try to keep you abreast of what we have heard. And so there's a lot more work to be done. I know the big three are going to be having some their own annual meetings, but then they're talking about a joint conference again to talk about these things. The possibilities are endless, but people need to step up and help with this.
Thank you. Kind of along the same line of Representative Leidiger's questions, as we hear from local units of government and people out there as to things that the state might do to help encourage, incent, move this forward, is your caucus going to be coming forward with ideas, legislative ideas for...
If they need legislation.
Okay.
I've already received one from somebody when I was in Dakota County, gave me some ideas for ways that would help things work better for them.
Okay.
And so people are coming forward. And it's not that I would have to carry the bills. I'm hoping that other people will come forward and want to embrace this and help with it. So it can't be just a few of us. It has to be all of us.
Well, if there are things that the state can do to help this process, we'd like to hear those ideas.
Well, part of the report will be, I think, approximately 10 of the ideas that surfaced as being ideas that could be attainable. And then there's going to be also some of the bigger barriers that we have so that we know the hurdles that we have to go through.
Well, thank you very much. And Representative Loeffler had to get to another commitment. Right. And so thank you very much, Representative McFarland. Appreciate the work that you continue to do in this area. Members, in the next section of this meeting, we wanted to provide an update on some of the key issues that we addressed during the last session. And as you know, we're in the process of trying to get a new accounting system up and working, the so-called SWIFT system. And there have been some bumps in the road, as there always are whenever you try to undertake a major enterprise like that. And I don't know about others of you on the committee, but I've had people expressing concern to me, local governments, individuals, businesses, who have been frustrated with the whole SWIFT conversion. And so we wanted to have Assistant Commissioner Moe come here today and give us an update as to how things are progressing. So welcome. And Mr. Mannion is also going to be joining us. So welcome, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, my name is Lori Moe. I am the Assistant Commissioner of the Accounting Services Division at Minnesota Management and Budget. And with me is Jim Mannion. He is the Program Director for our SWIFT project implementation. Since we were here with you last year during session, the first phase of the project has gone live, and SWIFT is is the statewide accounting and procurement system of record for fiscal year 12. We visited with you, Mr. Chairman, in September and provided a more detailed update. But in the interest of time today, we'll keep our presentation relatively high level and then answer any specific questions that you have. As you indicated, implementation of a very large, very complex system of this type is challenging in the best of circumstances. It's common to have a period of performance tuning and issue resolution. In our own case, the scenario was complicated somewhat by the July shutdown, and there continue to be various implementation issues that we're working to resolve. In the April, May, and June timeframe, prior to the go-live, since the last time we were here and prior to go-live, we completed a number of conversion steps. We worked with agencies to complete a wide range of configuration assignments. We trained nearly 2,500 system users, and we converted more than 200,000 active vendors. Since July 1st, the system has processed a large volume of activity, and you can see some of those numbers on slide number 3. And since the go-live, we've operated both an agency and a separate vendor help desk. The agency help desk has resolved more than 8,500 calls since the go-live. We've had questions across a wide range of subjects. How do I do X, Y, and Z? Where do I find this piece of information? Questions about specific functionality. Questions about reporting and retrieving information, all the way down to more technical questions related to security or related to access. We're also operating a vendor help desk, and you'll hear more about that in a couple of slides from Mr. Mannion. In September, we did pass an important milestone for the project when the Federal Highway Administration was here. They came in and audited the SWIFT system. That was a necessary step we had to pass before the Department of Transportation would be approved to generate federal billings from the new system, and we did pass the audit at that time. And so since the September audit, they have been doing all of their federal billings using SWIFT. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Mannion to walk you through a handful of slides here, and then we'll take questions.
Mr. Mannion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. The slide, I think everyone has a copy of the rather brief slides that we have here. If you have any questions on the first couple of slides, I'd be happy to address those. Any issues on the volume information? But I intend to start with slide number 4. In slide number 4, I wanted to make the point that the SWIFT project has been obviously a huge challenge for not only the project team, but the state and some of the external users of the application as well. But I think we are making very good progress. It's just one of those things when you implement something of this size, you should realistically expect to see some productivity hits against the organization, and we've experienced some of that. But I think that we are making very good progress on it. One of the things that we are trying to do, or that we are doing, is we are looking at the actual production processes, both online and batch, to improve them so that they work better not only for the state but also for the external entities. The other thing that's going on is the number of training sessions that we held. We had quite a few of them back in May and June prior to the go-live, and as Laurie indicated, we trained over 2,500 people on the SWIFT application, and when they came back, we continued to do that. We've had workshops with agency staff members, and we have had a lot of webinars, which is the web-based training courses as well, to try and communicate the best way to use the system. We think that has become productive. We find a lot of good feedback from participants that has helped them use the system and improve their efficiencies. The project itself, there was some deferred functionality that was mentioned, I think, the last time we were here when we met with you, Mr. Chairman, and that is primarily in the procurement area. That deferred functionality is still on track. It is something we will be doing next year. However, we are focusing primarily on improving the production processes that we've got in place already. The other thing that's on the bottom of slide 4 is we are looking and reevaluating some of the ways in which we implemented the SWIFT application. The direction that we were given, and I frankly think it was a good one, was to implement the SWIFT application with the minimum number of modifications. So what we did is basically that, and some of those decisions we are reassessing. One of the ones I mentioned here on the slide is the accounts receivable interface. It was basically a three-step manual process. The way the system was implemented, we were shrinking that down because we wanted to have it more productive to a single-step process. That'll have some benefits to the agencies in the way in which they use the system and interface to it. I mentioned here the user edits as well. The system is very complex, and it has a lot of options in it. And if you don't do the options correctly, it can cause you difficulty, and some of that is communicated by the training process, but I think in retrospect some of it needs to be actually modified so that we do more editing to prevent errors from occurring. Slide 5, the agencies are asking us fairly frequently about the reporting capabilities of SWIFT, and I just want to point out there are a series of reporting options that the agencies can use. The SWIFT system itself is primarily an online system. You can go into the different screens, and there are literally hundreds of them in the system, and look at the screens to identify purchase orders or inventory values or what have you. And there's a drill-down capability where you can click on it, and you go down to greater and greater levels of detail. That is one of the real pluses of the SWIFT application. Got a lot of good positive feedback from people who are using it. Another thing is there's a capability of what we call custom queries and reporting, and that you can actually run against the source system, the SWIFT application, a series of reports and queries that will give you data and reports in the format that you require, and you can download that to a Microsoft Office type application so that you could actually manipulate the data for your own purposes. And then there are extracts from the warehouse. There is a data warehouse, sometimes referred to as EPM, that the SWIFT application is producing. And there are extracts that we provide to agencies. There's actually 26 of them. And the agencies use that to feed their subsystems and actually drive their businesses. The last comment there is there are some key warehouse custom reports. Those are being built as well. There is a series of them that are already available to the agencies and provides different kinds of reports that they need for their own internal purposes. And in the future, we will continue to support these things, but we're also adding, as time goes on, more and more reports and queries out of the SWIFT system and out of this data warehouse. Just one comment for you. There were 60 reports and queries out of the SWIFT system 2 months ago. There's now 110. So there's a lot of progress being made on providing data to the agencies. The last slide is the SWIFT vendor. And as Lori mentioned to you, there's over 200 vendors that were converted out of the old app map system and added into the SWIFT application. And in case you're curious, there was a purge process that was run against that old vendor base in the map system before it was converted in an effort to reduce the size of the number of vendors that we'd be using. SWIFT introduces something called the self-service approach. If you go out into the business world out there, it's very common for vendors to do self-service. I'm sure some of you have gone online and you have ordered something, for example. You probably put in your name and address and phone number and contact and email and things of this nature. It's sort of the same thing with the vendors. This is a little bit new to some of them. We ask for them to put in the proper information, and then they have the ability to update things. So if their business moves, for example, they can go in and correct the business address. And that's a function that the SWIFT system does. It also allows them to put in things such as their tax ID number, which is needed for the W-9 information, and then the 1099 reporting, which the state is obligated to do. the SWIFT help desk received somewhere north of 200 phone calls from vendors when we were introducing the system. That was a lot of phone calls. It had a great deal of difficulty in us answering all of them. The phone calls were primarily asking how to register. Because what we did is we changed the vendor ID from what was on the old MAP system to the new one. There was really no option for that. So we required the vendors to re-register. Once they register, they don't seem to call back, but there is, as you've noticed here, a lot of vendors that SWIFT has to support. What we did in response to that, we actually looked at the portal that the vendors used and realized that it needed some improvement, and we did make some modifications to that portal. And we also changed some of the communication material that we were sending to the vendors. The end result of that is instead of having 200 calls a day now for vendors, we're down around the 50 to 75 level of calls, which interestingly is comparable to the number of calls we used to get on the old MAP system. I know I mentioned this to Lori a few days ago. If you basically said each of these vendors would call you once every 15 years, that basically equates out to about 50 calls a day. So I think that's a reasonably decent number to have, and I think that a lot of that is sort of the learning of the system, and over time the vendors get better at it, and I think we do as well. So that's basically what I wanted to communicate on the vendor. I'm open for questions.
You know, anytime you have a major conversion like this, obviously, and where you have to have vendors re-register, that there's going to be frustration out there. I understand that. And I've had that personal frustration myself. It took over a week to get any kind of answer from the help desk with regard to that. What really concerns me here are what I'm hearing, I've heard from local units of government that are experiencing excessive delays in getting reimbursed from the state, money that's owed to them. And are you putting some priority on trying to make that work? I mean, when we owe money to people out there, we ought, it seems to me, to have that as a high priority, to get those processed and reimbursements out in a timely manner. Is that a priority?
Absolutely. It is something that's very important to us. We realize that these cities and counties that get this money need this money to support their operations. So it has been a top priority for us. We do a substantial amount of research into the problem reports that we're getting. I am aware of your city of Moorhead question that you addressed to Commissioner Showalter. I looked at that one, Mr. Chair, and there's like 60 payments to the city of Moorhead out of the SWIFT application to the tune of about $13 million since the 1st of July. But, you know, we look at this material and we look at an aging process to see how long it takes to do that. There is really a series of reasons why a vendor may not get his...
No, go ahead. I'll add something.
Oh, you want to add something? Okay. But there's a series of reasons why a vendor might not get their payment on time, and it can be as simple as an educational training process where the individual who puts the request for payment in the SWIFT application fills out all of the data and fails to hit the submit button. We find that on occasion, and it's just a pure training thing. It can also be, and it's fairly common, that the vendors actually are paid. The problem for them is they don't realize that it comes in via electronic payment through ACH. It's in their bank account. I think the SWIFT application was live about a week, and one of the healthcare organizations indicated that they did not have a rather large payment, and we basically had to go in and look at their bank records and essentially prove it to them. That is not to say that the SWIFT application itself doesn't have some difficulties in processing all these things. But we really don't see at this, certainly from my point, a large occurrence of payments not being made in a timely manner.
Ms. Ball.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. If I could add to that, as Mr. Mannion pointed out, there's a variety of issues that we are addressing. In some cases, we have we're dealing with the learning curve of folks at agencies. We have added additional training courses. We're conducting workshops. We have added both technical resources and resources to our vendor help desk. The other thing that we're doing is we are monitoring our help desk activity both by system module and by subject of the question to identify issues, prioritize those issues, properly triage and assign resources, and we are absolutely making vendor help desk issues priority.
Well, the automated system there says that that you could expect it may take 48 hours to get a response, and that doesn't happen. So maybe that needs to be part of your monitoring to what is the response time, and make sure you tell people who are calling in trying to get help a realistic estimate as to what it's going to, how long it's
going
to take.
I would acknowledge to you that those helplines were overloaded, as indicated by the 200 calls a day when we started this thing. So,
well, then we need to be sending out the right message that it's going to take longer, and it's, if you make promises that you're going to get a response in 48 hours and it takes a week or more, that's a problem.
I agree.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Well, one of the things, when Mr. Chairman, when looking at your handout, just one request: whenever you put an acronym on, please always put the words that make it up. We kind of think we had it figured out, but we couldn't do it. And also, one of the best things SWIFT did was do this wonderful design for its symbol, which actually gave us a biologically accurate reproduction of a SWIFT. And I think you ought to put that on whenever you give something. But why don't you at least tell us what SWIFT stands for?
SWIFT stands for the Statewide Integrated Financial Tools. And I probably didn't explain FHWA, which is on here, which is the Federal Highway Administration. And MAPS, I think most of you know what that is. That's the old Minnesota Accounting and Procurement System.
I wonder if some people interpret SWIFT as that they're going to get a response quickly.
Yeah, know? Right. Maybe there should be a sub-explanation under it.
Other questions from the committee? Well, thank you. This is a huge challenge. I understand that, and I appreciate the difficulty that you're facing trying to get this going. But from my standpoint, I think the highest priority ought to be that we make reimbursements in a more timely manner here, and I hope that will continue to be a priority. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, Mr. Morocco will give us an update on the CGEP dependent audit that was a part of our legislation. Welcome, Mr. Morocco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I will just provide a couple of brief comments related to the dependent audit, and then certainly be available for comments or questions. First of all, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm director of the Employee Insurance Division. As part of that role, I oversee the state's employee group insurance program, where CGIP, as the chair had indicated. Until the contract is actually signed, and we are in the middle of the contracting process with the vendor, state law does limit the details that we can provide on this particular project. But just as a matter of fact, related to the law, we were required to issue an RFP for a dependent audit for the state's health and dental programs for state employees. We were able to issue that RFP early on August 22nd, and in doing so, we had three responses from very excellent vendors. We, as part of the RFP, we had required that they had implemented a dependent audit for large organizations like Estate, and specifically, it had to be other state experience as well as other large complex environments. So the vendors that responded were all highly qualified. We were very happy with the responses that we received. We did score them, and we are in the process of contracting with one of those responders to the RFP. We are hopeful to have that done here within the next couple of weeks, but I do say hopeful, being realistic that we are in the holiday season, and so there is some limited resources available on the vendor side as well as on the state side. But we certainly hope to have a contract in place by the end of the year, at which point then we will move forward with the dependent audit. What we would anticipate is a fairly straightforward process here, by where over once we have the contract signed, within the first 30 to 60 days, we will put the project plan together. We will initiate the communications to employees that we need all the dependents verified. Just as a point of reference, in the state's program, we have about 60% of state employees are carrying family coverage. So this will be a fairly large endeavor. We're looking at roughly about 30,000 state employees being contacted, and then assisting them through the process of providing the required documentation. Per the legislation, it was required upon this audit to do a document-based audit. So what that means is that there will need to be documents provided that positively identifies or establishes the relationship between the employee and the dependents. That may be marriage certificates, it may be adoption paperwork, it may be birth certificates, marriage certificates, those sorts of legal documents that provide that positive identification of the relationship between the employee and the dependent. We would anticipate being done sometime in the May to June time frame, ultimately having the final really product, I guess, or audit in place by July 1st of 2012. So that's sort of the rough timeline. I apologize for the limited amount of information that we have available, but again, until we sign a contract, we can't necessarily get into specifics about the actual vendor or some of those details. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, I'm sorry for missing the first part of your testimony. Did you address, and this may have come up last year too, but I've only ever worked in small and medium-sized businesses. Is this something typically that a large corporation would do to audit their employees' health benefits and the beneficiaries?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, I'm not sure that I have the expertise to answer that specifically. Certainly, audits are done in large organizations. I'm not sure that that's the predominant approach to dependent verification. I think more typical is an affidavit type environment where you're sort of enrolling on the honor system, but audits are certainly done in all sizes, small, medium, and large, but to answer that question perhaps in a little bit more detail, one of the things that has simplified dependents are some of the changes at the federal level. Dependent eligibility used to be a lot more complex. You no longer need to be a student in order to be eligible for health care beyond age 19. The age limit is now higher up to 26. Another component that's unique to the state is that we also do cover ex-spouses, which is another area where you typically would find more complexity within the dependent eligibility area. So I'm not sure that I answered that directly, but that's my take on kind of the frequency or likelihood of audits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, so the intention is not to require, for example, a marriage certificate for everyone who's trying to sign up a spouse for benefits, but only through the audit process. Certain selected people will be required to provide that documentation. Is that the intention?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, the legislation actually anticipated a full document-based audit. It did not propose a sort of random sampling, nor did it propose going forward that we do something different with new hires than what we might do with the existing group. So the intent and the dollars that were estimated as a result of the audit are based on a full-fledged full audit of the program, which means all dependents need to be positively identified as having a legal relationship as appropriate, as appropriate based on our program to the employee, so that they can be deemed eligible.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler,
Mr. Morocco, actually, I don't read the language to require that. It says conduct a document model dependent eligibility verification audit of all plans. And it may be that the numbers tied to it require that. But, this is a I would suggest, and I'm surprised that MMB hasn't required you to find the least obtrusive way of trying to get some of these financial results possible, because this is a unnecessarily invasive interference with the vast, vast, vast majority of people who have these benefits. I would expect as a legislator that even though this language is in place, that you would interpret it not as restrictively as possible, but as broadly and with the greatest amount of discretion as possible. Because you're really tracing down a really small amount of money, and you're requiring a great expense and a great inconvenience from 30,000 people to chase that little bit of money. So I would try to find the best way you can to find some money doing it, rather than to what I think is to interpret this language in a fairly draconian fashion. And certainly something that I've never experienced in the private sector.
Representative Slawy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, and actually, Representative Winkler, I agree with some of your comments and have concerns about this as well. I think when you testified last time, I was trying to track your language very closely about the vendor. I think you said you had three apply and you've chosen one, but you can't tell us who it is. Can you tell us if the vendor that testified before the committee was one of the three that applied?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that I cannot indicate who the vendors are, but I can certainly pose that question to the Department of Administration, and if they would allow that release, I would be happy to follow up and let you know who the actual vendors are.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawy.
Yeah, just as I recall, I think he was a former state representative, and he was kind of potentially going to get some business, and here he was testifying, and so, yes, I am curious if he got the contract and would like to know that and how much it was for and so forth. Thank you.
Mr. Morocco, I know that there have been some privacy questions that have been raised here. Can you say something about protection of privacy initiatives that will be a part of this whole process? How privacy is going to be protected?
Sure. Mr. Chair, and for members of the committee, that certainly is one of the foremost issues that we are also concerned with. We don't have a lot of specifics at this point because, again, we haven't even entered into a contract yet, but certainly as part of the RFP process, we made that issue very clear to the bidding vendors, that was going to be an important consideration. Privacy from the perspective of what kind of documents might be required, how are we going to store those, how long are we going to maintain those. Certainly what we're looking to do is to create the least amount of work and disruption and intrusion in order to carry this out. And I think that, certainly, we want to be respectful about the process. What I would anticipate are typical kinds of documentation like birth certificates and marriage certificates. What I would anticipate is collecting only that is necessary to to illustrate or confirm the relationship between the employee and the dependent, and to maintain those documents for the as least amount of time as possible. Now, that said, again, we haven't walked through the process of what exactly those documents are going to be and how long are we going to need to maintain them, how will they be provided. We know we've talked through different kinds of secure fax environments, email, traditional mail, but again, those will be the things that will be worked out through the vendor as part of the first 60 days of planning. We did, and we always do, include the Office of Enterprise Technology on these kinds of RFPs. Because we work in the medical environment here, we're very concerned about privacy, we're very concerned about HIPAA, and so OET not only provides us the language that we used as part of the RFP language, they are also a scorer and an evaluator of the responses as it relates to, you know, security and privacy, as it relates to systems, how is the data going to be stored, how is it going to be managed while idle as well as in transition, and not only evaluating that for our needs internally at MMB, but also how those vendors are storing that information perhaps on within their systems, not only the vendors themselves, but any of the third parties that they may contract with, ensuring that all links within this chain are going to meet the standards that you know an organization like OET is going to require for state systems, and that we would expect as a program, you know, that we are safeguarding this information.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Morocco, you had made a statement that you're looking at complying with this with documents of current employees of the state and their dependents. So my question is, and applying that to new employees or new dependents, so are you telling me that if someone has a child, they're going to have to provide a birth certificate for their newborn to the state so that person is covered? And then are you going to be required to hold on to that birth certificate for 26 years as long as eligibility for insurance is there? Is that what you're telling me?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Karen, Representative, we don't know for sure what we will do long term. To answer your first question about new hires or perhaps a birth, a new birth, I would anticipate that would require a document in order to be an eligible dependent. If you look at the legislation, the vendor is to work with us on and create a sort of a roadmap for how to manage dependent eligibility moving forward. And so as part of fulfilling that RFP, we're certainly going to look to the expertise of the vendor or the vendors who do this for a living, and really know sort of the best practice and common practices that are out there. Certainly, we'll take that into consideration along with other concerns or considerations that we may have as a program. Certainly, that you as legislators may have. So, to answer your second question about how long we may keep those documents, I don't know for certain. Certainly there is documentation that we do keep on file, as an example, your beneficiaries for your life insurance. So that's something where obviously we need to keep that on record. If you are making an enrollment change, whether it be self-service or through some kind of paper application, we do keep that information on file, because should there be a question down the road, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the road about, you know, did this person actually make an election and what did they elect, we need some form of documentation. Now, what we may be able to do is just simply keep track of the fact that a documentation has been supplied and did meet the requirements, and perhaps not actually keep the document itself as part of the official enrollment record. So I think we have some options, but those will be things we'll need to explore.
Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Morocco, and I'm not sure if it's a question or not, but it seems to me that we're putting a bunch of financial burden on our employees to produce documentation that their dependents are their dependents and their spouse is their spouse and their beneficiary is their beneficiary and so on and so forth. And it kind of alarms me that the people who advocate for limited government are insisting on doing this to state employees. But so if I name, for example, my brother as a beneficiary on my life insurance policy, am I going to have to produce some documents to prove that he's my brother? And quite frankly, I'm thinking this whole thing is rather insane.
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I use the life insurance as an example, but this audit is specifically for the health and dental program, so there would be no documentation required.
I have one final question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gaffney.
Is there a history of state employees fraudulently declaring dependents to the point that we need a document audit? I mean, how pervasive is fraud?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, certainly there are cases where fraud has existed. You know, it would be unusual to get more than a handful a year, you know, maybe two or three. And I'm not even sure that I would necessarily classify them as fraud. You know, certainly there, in an example of a divorce, say, employees don't necessarily run to us or run to their HR offices saying, hey, you know, look, you know, I just got divorced. And so there can be instances where I think it's less fraud and just simply a lack of understanding about sort of, you know, who really qualifies and who doesn't. So, but certainly, you know, we would see a handful a year where those types of things do happen. I can't really predict, you know, whether or not it's necessary because I don't know what this audit is necessarily going to find.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess observation I would make is maybe it wouldn't actually make sense to go through a random sampling first to kind of get an idea of whether it's actually worthwhile doing this, and I think the legislation is sufficiently flexible to permit that. One question about the vendor payment. Is this? Can you describe the payment structure? Is this an upfront kind of straight state contract? Are they taking a percentage of money recovered? Or is there some other kind of mechanism? Can you share with us how they're getting paid?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I can't provide specifics because the contract isn't signed. However, we did ask through the RFP that different kinds of payment models be presented. And we will obviously pick, you know, whatever we think is going to be most cost effective for the state. But we did look at both a pay for performance type payment system as well as a straightforward, you know, just sort of flat fee or perhaps per member type of an expense. But ultimately, what we contract with, that's sort of what we're working through now. And be happy to share that once it becomes available in public.
Mr. Chair, just
Representative Winkler,
final observation. I would be very, I guess, concerned if there is a vigilante payment system that we're dealing with here when people have to put together records in order for benefits to be paid. When we're talking about knowledge of 2 to 3 cases per year right now without any further understanding of where these problems might come from, I understand that these numbers came from other states and other vendors. But you have to really look at the cost of implementation to the employees, the disruption to them, and the money received, and the interests in the vendor of getting paid as a percentage of the problems that they can find. It seems to me that we are doing this pretty blindly, and I would reiterate that never in any small or medium-sized business that I've been a part of have I had to get a marriage certificate in order to have my wife on the insurance.
If there are no further questions, Mr. Morocco, thank you for the update. And we look forward to hearing more about it as time goes on here. Next, Commissioner Showalter. We're going to get an update on the pay for performance bond proposal that was a part of our legislation. Commissioner, welcome.
good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, a Commissioner of Management and Budget. Appreciate the opportunity to be with the committee and just briefly update you on the Pay for Performance Act. A pilot that was, just like the previous topic, part of the legislation from last year's budget bill. The Pay for Performance Act is a pilot and really an attempt to look at using a couple of different mechanisms in a new way. The Commissioner of Management and Budget is authorized to issue $10 million in appropriation bonds. The proceeds from that issuance are to be paid out to providers upon demonstrated results that are pre-agreed to between the state and those providers. That's the broadest outline, and we can certainly get into more details, but within that, there are quite a few legal, financial, and sort of programmatic issues that we are starting to get into and look forward to working through and talking with you more in the future. We're not alone in trying to work through this model. I was just recently participating in a White House summit around this particular financing vehicle and looking at this or other types of innovative financing to see how they might work. Right now, there's only one place on Earth that has done this in England, but there are a number of other projects that are coming up. All of them are a little bit different, all of them examining slightly different theories of how this might work out. From that, I think we are learning quite a few things, and I'll talk about those in just one second. In terms of the absolute status of where we're at, we are convening or sort of forming the oversight group. As statute authorizes the commissioner to do, looking through the kinds of expertise and experiences that we might find useful as that oversight group. I've met with the internal administration commissioners that are already named on this group, and then we will determine and sort of invite others to form that oversight group. I'd expect that to be ready in about January timeframe. With that in place, we will continue to be investigating that funding model, the appropriation bond model, which certainly has some hurdles and some issues that we will need to work through before we're actually able to go forward with any grant agreements. In the meantime, I think we've got the third piece of looking forward to the granting process, the methodology, the return on investment issues that are significant and important elements to the incentives that this model suggests. What we've learned so far include several things. One is I would posit to the committee that the funding mechanism, the appropriation bonds, isn't the innovation. It is all about the granting mechanism, the pay-for-performance element, and the very clear and concrete metrics and responsibility for that performance. How we can make that a clear agreement between the state and the providers, provide the incentive so that that data is legit, known and accepted by the granting agency as well as the legislature and the public is an important element. Two, that actually getting that fiscal savings in the future is an important element of the discipline. I think Peter Hutchinson was before you earlier today, and certainly he and other people in the foundation community are interested in this model and talking with local partners as well on pay-for-performance models out of their own programming dollars. So this is an element of fiscal discipline and an element of sort of accountability, putting it into the contracts that will be very interesting. Finally, not every activity will work. When I talked with a professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard about this model and you know, what kinds of activities would be useful, one of his first comments was, don't do it on core business. Do it on things that can fail. Places where, you know, if the state funding goes away, that incentive is really there for the providers to act. As a result, in the literature, commonly you see elements such as supportive housing, job training, and employment, and a number of different other activities where they're important, but they aren't necessarily going to the core of providing basic education or direct prison activities. Might be working on recidivism in the correctional institutions, but not necessarily the prisons themselves. So those are a couple of the lessons we've learned so far. I have appreciated the significant amount of interest from the nonprofit community, from the foundations, from the public on this topic, and we will having conversations. I look forward to having more conversations and making some more concrete progress in the coming months.
Thank you, Commissioner. Can you put any kind of timetable on when you think we'll be ready to move forward?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to. I think depending on how the appropriation bond mechanism works out. We may end up having to do a request for information phase this spring that would allow vendors and nonprofit organizations to talk about how they might implement a program before we could actually do a request for proposal. So my guess right now is that the likely path is forming the executive committee, the oversight committee in January, putting together a request for information in that month or the following month so we can start engaging possible participants in it, start to identify a couple of likely candidates as we work through the return on investment methodology and what's practical and implementable. By that time in late spring, hopefully we will have a clear path to understanding whether we can back a contract, whether we have the authorization to enter into a contract with these vendors.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just ask a question. You can catch me offline or give me the materials offline. I know we just chatted very briefly yesterday, and there's been a couple of mentions other places about possible questions or hurdles with the bonds and perhaps even legal opinions from the Attorney General. I guess maybe just make a formal request here, if I could, to have whatever those letters or opinions or whatever it is forwarded, and just make sure I've got everything relative to the bonding questions as they exist today.
Sure, I'd be happy to follow up.
Thank you.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just a comment, and then I have a question for the Commissioner. You know, it occurs to me this is the first hearing we've had since the agreement, since the shutdown. And so I think I was thinking, why do we have so many questions? I think it's because we weren't in the room, and so we're now going back and remembering and kind of learning what was passed and what's happening with that. So with that, I'll ask the Commissioner a question. And this has to do, and I'm still trying to understand this, because again, you know, as you remember, all those deals were made in the last weekend, and we didn't have a lot of time to absorb it. Along the line of the bonding, the rumors out there, and I'm sure Representative Downey has heard them and we're hearing them, is that potentially it's not going to work out. I mean, is there a certain time where you pull the plug if I think you said the backing has to be confirmed. Is there potential? I mean, is that for sure going to go through, or is there some? Yeah, can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure, Commissioner.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll try to sort of in summary talk and be happy to provide more detail offline. But the short version is the appropriation bond mechanism isn't a common bonding issuance, and I think there's other issues that are relevant in order to get a clear bill of approval on issuing those bonds. So until we've got that, and there's a number of different factors involved, until we've got that, I don't have the cash really to go forward. From the committee's perspective and from my perspective as being designated by the language as trying to combine this, I think it's still a very interesting experiment regardless of the funding mechanisms. And I'm not sure that the state's ability to issue bonds is necessarily the value and the learning we're going to get out of this. It's whether we can issue grants in a little different way and if we can enter into some kind of more flexible arrangement rather than specifying specifics. You know, when I've had other conversations with people and they've read some of the literature, it seems like that's some of the interesting value that government can get out of this. The financing mechanism would be just the same. If you put $10 million in a pot, forgot the appropriation bonds, and said, here's a grant, here's dollars, go figure it out. If government can figure out that contracting process better, that's a great thing. Part of the Minnesota model that's here is not just the appropriation bonds that you referenced. It's also whether ultimately the private market might enter into that sort of upfront process of sort of providing the upfront cash with the state providing funds later. So it's a long-winded way of saying there's several different bonding issues involved here, and we have to work through them.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. So is it $10 million? Was that that was the agreed-upon?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, okay. Yes, it was.
And Mr. Chair, yes, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's very interesting, and I have a background in nonprofits, so it is the great experiment. I just hope you will keep us posted, and Mr. Chair, I think it was really good to see where what the progress is. It'd be interesting to see, you always wonder, every once in a while we learn about sort of bonding deals that went through or bills that were passed, and then the bonding bill money was never spent for the bonding because the project didn't start for some reason or for another. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those that, you know, it has that little bit of an unwieldy feel because you have both the experimental part with the project, which is, I think, the real vision that Representative Downey and the nonprofits have, which I think is good, but then you have the interesting financing. And, yeah, if those two can mesh and ultimately have the experiment pay off is the million-dollar question, I guess.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this is really great discussion, and ongoing scrutiny and fine-tuning of this is going to be, I think, good and helpful. So I do appreciate the chance to hear from the commissioner. I would maybe depart from the commissioner's statement that the real value is figuring out how we measure the programs and then figure out whether you can actually track the return on investment to the state and somehow pay for that out of the state budget. I agree that's a tough challenge and a big piece of this, but I think the original vision was that plus the fact that you would utilize a bonding mechanism to attract outside capital, private investment in these ventures. And so it isn't just the opportunity to measure our programs and see whether they're generating a return. It's also an opportunity to attract private capital towards these public purposes in a new way other than taxation. So I think the author or the originator of the idea would argue as strongly for continuing that part of the pilot as with the measurement piece as well.
Commissioner, thank you very much. Appreciate your being here, and we have a couple of other people who had requested to be heard on this subject, Ms. Becker and Mr. Paulson. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Stacy Becker. I'm part of the Invest in Outcomes team, a nonprofit that was formed to help get pay for performance and human capital bonds off the ground in Minnesota. We're really, really excited about the legislation that was passed, and we're working really hard to help support the implementation, and that's the subject of my remarks today. Steve Rothschild, who founded Invest in Outcomes, had really regrets that he's not be able to be here himself today. So, as has been mentioned, this is really unprecedented. There is the one experiment in England. No place has done human capital bonds. So, Invest in Outcomes is really committed to ensuring the best possible pilot that we can do. And to that end, we've done a couple of things. Pulled together experts to work on the various technical work needed. The commissioner mentioned that there are a lot of technical issues. All of this work is being self-financed. Invest in Outcomes is financing this work so that the burden doesn't fall on the state. And we have also been communicating with various state officials, including Commissioner Showalter, about the work we're doing and how we can best cooperate to make this thing come off. So our work to date, and I'll be very brief, we've put together a timeline of an implementation timetable and a list of tasks, and this is really based on the legislation that you passed. And as the commissioner mentioned, you know, the critical path is really getting this oversight committee up and going. The evaluation component is really critical to the success of the pilot for two reasons. One is we need to be able to measure the return on investment to the state. Invest in Outcomes has contracted with Wilder Research, which has prepared an evaluation plan. And the, I think, kind of exciting thing is that Wilder is working with DEED and United Way to refine that ROI methodology. DEED has also been required by legislation to do an ROI for workforce training programs. And so we've agreed that we should all work together to get the hot, you know, use the same methodology, the same assumptions, so that we have a really, really credible number in the end. And that work is going forward, and some of the most cooperative work I've ever been a part of. Part of that evaluation is to ensure that the outcomes and payments to the service providers are truly based on the impacts, the effects of that program. The evaluation will use a comparison group of folks who didn't receive the services. The people working on this methodology are trained economists, and we feel really confident that we're going to be able to come up with something that really can show outcomes and impacts. The other reason the evaluation is important is because it's never been done before, and we imagine we're going to learn a lot through this pilot, and Wilder has also put together an evaluation plan for that. It's likely that the service, or probable that the service providers may need some working capital. Remember that they only get paid once the outcome is shown, so they will have some upfront costs in providing the services. So Invest in Outcomes is working with the Nonprofit Assistance Fund to develop a working capital fund. Some portion of that will probably be non-recourse loans. And we're moving forward on trying to figure out how much assistance those non-profit providers might be. The commissioner mentioned that not all services work in this model, and so the other thing that we've done, Wilder has done, is an evaluation on what type of services might work the best. We have been working closely with United Way on workforce training. I'm going to let Brian Paulson tell you a little bit more about that. We've also met with DHS and a number of assistant commissioners and program directors on if they've got aging services that, for example, could delay entrance into a nursing home or otherwise reduce Medicaid costs. And I think there might be some really promising things there that DHS has in mind. Just a couple more points. Later this month, Steve Rothschild will be meeting with a funders group who kind of helped get Invest in Outcomes going in at the beginning to help support this evaluation work, to help support and underwrite the Working Capital Fund. We did meet, as I mentioned, with Commissioner Showalter on October 11th and offered support in all of the ways I've just been describing. We really hope that when the Oversight Committee convenes that it can get off the ground running. So we've been trying to do some of this technical work that can provide a basis for the discussions right off the bat. Commissioner Showalter asked us to provide some lists of experts or names who might be good for that oversight committee, and we have done that. And then finally, also as Commissioner Showalter mentioned, Mr. Rothschild was also at those discussions at the federal level with OMB, who is looking at models like this, and is really trying to get them interested, and they've indicated very preliminarily that they would be, in their participation in the Minnesota model. A lot of the benefits and the cost savings to the state also accrue to the federal government. So if when we're successful, the federal government will also be a recipient. And they have provided some preliminary interest in perhaps financing or waivers should they be necessary. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Becker, you said we were going to have a timeline.
We Invest in Outcomes kind of took a look and said, you know, if you want to do this pilot, we put together a schedule of a timeline and tasks based on the legislation. But we recognize that it's not our timeline. It's really, you know, that you invested the authority with Commissioner of MMB, and it's really their timeline. The critical path is the Oversight Committee, and we had hoped that would get going in January, and it sounds like it will. So everything kind of flows as I think Commissioner Showalter. We were just trying to understand, you know, what's this big, rather, you know, set of tasks that needs to get done.
So all the things that you were talking about, when will the conclusion be, probably?
That would be up to the commissioner, and I think what the commissioner described as the process for RFIs and RFPs is one that will play out, and our role and what we've offered is to keep supporting that by the work we're doing. Am I not understanding your question correctly?
Well, are we... Mr. Chair, Ms.
Representative Murphy.
Mm-hmm. Are we talking 2012 or 2013 or 2022?
Ms. Becker.
I believe, according to what the commissioner just said, that he would hope to start issuing our request for information this year and then RFPs this year, so we could actually get the first set of providers underway in 2012 if we figure out the funding issue. Okay. That was my understanding from the commissioner.
And, Mr. Chair, Ms. Becker, and so your group, which I can't remember. Invest in Outcomes is fronting the money to the nonprofits or to the...
We're doing two things. There's a lot of technical work that needs to get done. For example, just figuring out the ROI and the valuation plan. And we are developing and paying for the development of that evaluation and the ROI. Now, it will obviously be up to the state and the Oversight Committee and Commissioner Showalter to what extent they want to use what we've been preparing. But what we've been trying to do is use the best minds out there, so we think it's good work in any event that they can then launch from. The other thing that Invest in Outcomes will be trying to fund is this working capital. The legislation does not say anything about working capital, but in conversations with service providers, it would appear, you know, that they don't necessarily have the resources to upfront the services. And so that is something that Invest in Outcomes is going forward and trying to do. And yes, it's not state money, it's private foundation money.
And Mr. Chair,
Murphy,
one last question then. And so it's possible though that the Oversight Committee and Commissioner and the department might not accept all this research that's done and the things that you're working so hard on and having such a good time with. And so your initial investment might be turned back to you. You can do with what you want with the results, but the state doesn't have to go any further.
Is that correct? Possible.
Ms. Becker? Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Becker. Mr. Paulson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to present today. My name is Brian Paulson. I work with Greater Twin Cities United Way. As Stacy indicated, we did convene a number of United Way job training providers in November to hear more about the model, provide input, engage their interest, and we did receive strong interest from those providers in participating in a pilot project to explore this. We have a number of high-performing nonprofit job training providers who do see this as an opportunity, who do believe that the economic value they create does cover the costs of service delivery, and are interested in partnering with Invest in Outcomes and the planners in moving forward a pilot. At United Way, we also see this as an opportunity to really focus on what we invest in, which is outcomes, and focusing very clearly on performance and accountability, and making best use of limited resources.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, I'm just trying to understand the funding here. And you know, Ms. Becker, we worked on early childhood issues together, so I know. And there's often a lot of collaborative funding in early childhood. So, exactly how is Invest in Outcomes funded? Is it grant money from different foundations pooled into this group called Invest Outcomes that exists for the sole purpose of moving this forward? Is that?
Yes.
Yes. Can you tell us who the funders are?
I don't have that information offhand, but I can get that for you.
Yeah, I'd like that. Mr. Chair, I think it makes a difference just to know. And this is often how we move issues forward, and also in working with United Way. And it's an interesting model, and one, I have to say, I think it's really good that foundations are getting involved in public policy work. I think it's a very appropriate role. But it also is good for us to know kind of where the money's flowing from and those types of things.
Yes, I think it was many of the same ones that have been here today, but I'd be happy to get you the full list.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick comment to Representative Murphy's question. I think the nonprofit and foundation community actually has a lot to contribute to the state in terms of tracking returns and what works and what doesn't. So I'm actually pretty hopeful that what the group is coming up with will be a huge value add to the state, and I'm hopeful that the state will accept it and they won't be turned back to just run with it on their own. And then just a question, if I could, for Ms. Becker. You mentioned the comparison of the population that's being looked at versus a control group, and my recollection is that the return on investment will be the margin between the benefit from the program versus the control group. So we're literally not paying for just good activity, but what the incremental good activity was from the program.
Yes, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being here and for your involvement and support for this pilot project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The last update item on our schedule for today is to get a report on the status of the tax analytics and tax compliance initiatives that were part of our state government finance bill this year. Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, Mr. Matt Mossman, is here, and Ms. Steenblatt.
That's my new word for last year. You don't have to be part of the ass. I think you should take roll, Mr. Check us out by the suck ups.
The battery is critical.
Oh, no, it's not plugged in.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll see if we can get Matt Mossman, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Revenue, and with me is Terry Steenblatt, our Assistant Commissioner for Individual Taxes. We are here today to provide an update of tax analytics and tax compliance initiative that was much discussion last legislative session and really has been an important part of the department's efforts for many years, and so is an important issue for us as well as I know for the committee. And one of the things, you know, we've been hearing a number of things I think came out of the conversation last year with the legislature that we really want to be in tune with it, and but to prioritize a couple of those I think was just the notion of trying to find a ways for us to do our tax compliance effort, which is significant in the state, as efficiently as possible, and also to be mindful of customer service and other issues with you all hearing from taxpayers who are subject to audits, as well as us wanting to make sure that we have a good relationship with taxpayers in the state, given that voluntary compliance is really the main way that we collect taxes in the state and is going to continue to be. With that, the presentation we put together today, and I think some hard copies have gone around, so that is we're working here to see if we can't get it up on the screen. We did just want to talk very briefly about a few things that we think that are important that really surround the tax analytics and compliance discussion and that help facilitate the effort. You all are very familiar with the integrated tax system, GenTax, and just a reminder that we'll be in phase four of rolling that integrated tax system out in February of 2012. We expect to roll out the final phase of that with our special tax areas, cigarette, lawful gambling taxes, and some other special tax areas, so that we will have integrated fully all of the main taxes that we collect in one system. And that's very meaningful both for our audit and compliance efforts as well as for e-services and some customer service functions we'll talk about later. In addition, one of the things that we've been working on since the last time we've been before the legislature is enhancing our individual income tax assistance. We get a lot of phone calls, as you know, from taxpayers, and in addition to rolling out phase four, we've been working to help make sure that there is a better system for taxpayers to both get their phone calls handled when they call in. In particular, we're working to reprogram the scripts for the telephones and in particular to help with the where's my refund function, so that when taxpayers, because most of our calls are for where is my refund, and it's really something that can bog us down and bog down our ability to get back to helping taxpayers have the information they need to fill out their tax forms. We will be rewriting and reprogramming that system so that it's more stable from a technological standpoint this next tax season, as well as providing a more robust set of information for taxpayers when they log in, so that they'll have a better sense of the timeline as to when they can actually expect to get their refund. We also did, Mr. Chairman, set up in response to some various things that have happened with the department over the last couple of years, an internal audit committee and function, which we're and staff that function up a little bit, and we just want to, that may be something that is for a later discussion as well, but we just wanted to highlight that that's a function that we are very proud that we have in place, so that we can work on developing an agency risk assessment and communication plan, ramping up the internal audit function, and in particular introducing a whistleblower hotline for employees within the agency, so that we have more avenues for identifying more quickly issues that we should be resolving internally to protect the resources of Minnesota taxpayers. We are working aggressively, for those of you who may utilize our website routinely or even periodically, we're working aggressively on simplifying the navigation and enhancing the navigation of our website. We were hoping to roll that out soon. We think that we'll at least have a site that both legislative staff and members of the public and other people who use our website can begin testing around mid-January, but we're rewriting it to better organize and utilize the content, and also enhancing the searchability of the website. Just to underscore, this is our website we find to be a very critical tool to enhancing both voluntary tax compliance and answering taxpayers' questions. We find it to be one of our primary resources for people to get information about the taxes they owe and how they file. The governor, as you know, has been pressing and prioritizing for all state agencies to instill a culture of continuous improvement throughout state government, and to look for opportunities to make efficient and efficiency gains, both in terms of how we do our work and as well as the quality that we do our work. And we at the Department of Revenue are attempting to institutionalize those as well in the department. We were fortunate to have been awarded recently the Governor's Award for Continuous Improvement Award for an electronic check presentment process improvement that we initiated and implemented over the last year and a half, by which we will no longer take paper checks. We receive many paper checks through the mail, and we will scan those into the system and process them, present them to checks, those checks to banks electronically rather than in paper form, both an efficiency for us and for the banks. And so that's a process improvement that we're very proud of. And to lead into the next couple slides, just one comment on tax reform. I'm sure many of you are aware that the commissioner has been having a number of discussions and anticipates to continue to have discussions on tax reform generally throughout the state and with the legislature. And I highlight it here because it really ties in, I think, to the efficiency of how the overall system works, especially along the lines of the simplicity tax principle. There's a number of tax principles I think that effort will be looking at, both tax fairness as well as simplicity and competitiveness of the tax system. But we're already noticing this throughout the last year, a number of opportunities to simplify the system across tax types that's basically been facilitated by the completion of the integrated tax system and GenTax, that going through that whole process has caused us as a department to have to look at things like penalties and interest and just various provisions of the different tax types and see if there aren't ways to make them more efficient and more consistent across tax type. And then finally, before I lead into the specific discussion on tax analytics, I really want to highlight e-services, which we rolled out, began rolling out in October. We have, for businesses that we serve in the state, we have a new e-services system that is part of our integrated tax system. It provides taxpayers an opportunity to view all of their account information online. It is much more flexible than the system that existed prior to that, and it allows taxpayers to conduct web messaging with the department. It gives them access electronically to all the communications they've had with the department. If they are a taxpayer who works with us on multiple tax types, they can see all those tax types on one platform. They can access their information 24 hours a day. And I think in particular, for taxpayers who work with, for businesses, I should say, it really simplifies businesses for them and for their accountants or bookkeeping services, providers in the industry that might work with multiple businesses can have those businesses log in and give them confidential access to the taxpayer's account. So that if you're an accounting firm, you can actually work with all 20 or all 10 or all 15 of your clients at the same time by logging into the system once you've been granted that access by the taxpayer. So it's very user-friendly and customer-friendly for taxpayers, and we've been logging that out. It's been a great success. And one of the things that we're hoping to do is to, or we will be doing, is having a demonstration of the e-services functionality for legislative staff and interested legislators on December 14th. We're really hopeful that by doing so, not only might it help answer questions that you all might get or your offices might get from your constituents, but also, frankly, to help promote this as is a much more efficient way among your constituents to help utilize the services at the Department of Revenue and to help businesses to pay and integrate with the department their taxes more efficiently. Related to that, on a local government note, it involves mostly local governments, but also pretty much all functions of the real estate industry and the Department of Revenue's property tax administration division. But we also have, in the last year, about 4 months ago now, rolled out ECRV, which is the electronic transmittal of real estate certificates of real estate value, which is a very cumbersome, paper-heavy process that involves many, many entities, and we're now able to begin doing that electronically. Moving on to what I think is slide number six, I believe it would be in your document. This timeline here gives an update on the tax analytics RFP process and where we're at today. Back in April, as you may recall, the governor initiated an effort, and Commissioner Cronk and the Department of Administration put a notice in the State Register and began pursuing RFPs for data analytics efforts across state government, including both for tax analytics and for other data analytics functions. In May, that process played out through pre-proposal meetings with contractors, and the deadline for submitting questions to the state for feedback to interested vendors. The deadline for submitting proposals was June 27th, and the department began evaluating those proposals immediately once the proposal deadline had come to an end and all deadlines for proposals were submitted. My understanding is that there were 29 proposals, Mr. Chair and Committee, that were submitted, and 22 proposals have been selected throughout August and October. A number of evaluation teams, of which the Department of Revenue had staff involved, evaluated the proposals and scored the proposals. During the month of contractors were selected, and it's taken some time to negotiate contracts with the selected vendors, and that process took place throughout the month of November, with signed contracts now for the most part with most vendors in November and December, and we now at the department at the agency levels are beginning to initiate specific conversations about those with those vendors. A little bit about we, of course, at the department have not been waiting for the contract process to complete. We have done taken a number of steps in order to anticipate this, frankly, very exciting time. We have created an analytics steering team during the course of the late summer and fall, and that team worked hard on providing both some education around analytics within the department to key staff who were going to be involved both on that team and who were going to be eventually interacting with the potential products and services offered by contractors. We've held a number of brainstorming sessions on the potential for analytics and how the analytics application might, what areas of the agency's operations might be most appropriate to begin those increased analytics. We contacted other states to discuss their use of analytics and got more research and information in that regard, and we conducted research as well with the federal taxpayers administrators. We're anticipating, Mr. Chairman, based on those discussions, that as we both as we start to look at the tools that are available and line them up with our needs, that we'll have the opportunity to deploy tax analytics in three potential areas. One is return processing in terms of this is a little bit of pre-audit, if you will, as we're processing returns and doing analytics at that point for seeing what the chances are that a refund should be reviewed before it's paid out. Also, some audits using looking at our existing audit selection criteria to see if we could apply our existing audit selection criteria in a different way. And then to identify the potential for new audit criteria that we perhaps don't use at this point. The next slide gives a list of, I indicated that 10 of the 22 vendors that have been selected or identified by the Department of Administration have been selected in the area of tax analytics. The remainder are offering analytics services in other areas, and some of these vendors may also be offering services and other areas of analytics also, but you can see the 10 entities here listed on this page. Master contracts have been awarded, and so now's the time really where agency-specific conversations are beginning, and as we learn more detail about the products and services that these vendors offer, based on, you know, the three areas that I talked about, we'll be looking at how we can utilize analytics to enhance the effectiveness of our overall compliance efforts. So we're right, Mr. Chair and committee members, I think, about where we thought we would be on this timeline. Fortunate to have started the process in April. Obviously, the identification of vendors and the RFP process does take some time in the evaluation of those vendors. So we think we're about right where we expected to be, having identified master contracts, and now we're able to begin working with those contractors for specific functions. I can pause there on tax analytics if there's some questions. Otherwise, we do just have one slide to update on the tax compliance initiative generally.
Mr. Mossman, yep. Representative Slawick had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Mossman. I'm trying to, you know, again, these bills were passed over a weekend. I'm trying to remember the language. We have 10 vendors. I mean, what am I missing here? So there's how much money going towards this to find how much money? I just trying to get the context, because the context was a while ago that we last heard about this.
Mr. Osman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, you may recall that as the conversations were occurring during the legislative session, the governor had also been expressing interest, obviously, in pursuing a tax analytics or a data analytics initiative as well. And so the administration initiated prior to the end of the regular legislative session, prior to the end of an agreed-upon budget back in April, the administration initiated a data analytic pursuit of data analytics RFP and function. And so the Department of Administration, beginning in April, issued a request for proposal for a range of tax analytics services. You may recall that Human Services is looking at using data analytics. The Department of Administration for Energy Efficiency is looking at using data analytics services. So it really crosses all of state government, the effort does, and as well as tax analytics. And so the master contract process, and there is Betsy Hayes is here, I know, from the Department of Administration, if you have more specific questions too on that process. But the master contract process then, as I understand it, identifies a number of qualified vendors that can then provide services in certified areas to the state agencies. And so what we anticipate is that these vendors here that pursued qualification for tax analytics services may provide a variety of different tools and skills and capabilities and products in the area of tax analytics, some which might fit well with the agency, some which might not. So there would be the potential to use one or multiple of these vendors potentially for different services, and that's the point in the process that we're at now.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to, I remember that the governor came out with sort of analytics and sort of decided he embraced the idea. And so these are master contract awards, but they're not really awards at all. They're just awards as good guys. It's sort of like a stamp of approval that they can do business with the state, and or they'll be the pool, or they each have a contract to do something.
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawik, my understanding is that they are broad contracts to do, at being qualified to do certain things, but whether they're not necessarily a contract we would enter into if they were selected by the Department of Revenue to provide now a specific service, we would enter into a subsequent contract with them to provide a specific tax analytics service to the department.
Mr. Chair, so they're kind of qualified. They were qualified as meeting certain requirements to do business with the state on a good level.
Right.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you.
Here. You may proceed.
So, Mr. Chairman, we are excited to, obviously, to be in position to move forward on the tax analytics functionality, I think particularly so with the next slide. We are, of course, at the beginning of the initiative, and just to remind the committee, the initiative, the new tax compliance initiative ultimately appropriated $13.7 million new money last legislative session to the department, with the expectation that over the fiscal 12-13 biennium, the department would collect $82.3 million in new initiative tax compliance revenues. And just to be clear, of course, that's on top of what would be about $892 million of tax compliance revenues that the department would anticipate collecting over the course of the current biennium through its ongoing tax compliance efforts that have been built into the base from previous initiatives. So this $82 million that's on top of the $892 million is the new initiative. We are just starting, and while we do oftentimes the initiatives do start, have a bit of a slow start and then ramp up, we have to date collected $2.1 million of revenue of the $82.3 million, and we've expended only about $400,000 of the $13.7 million appropriated. And that has been primarily for staff to begin the new initiative in anticipation now of moving forward with both some combination of enhanced tax analytics as well as as traditional tax compliance efforts and matching those up. So we do, we're not ready to sound any alarm bells. We are concerned that we're a few months behind on the initiative, but we are anticipating now as we head into the next year and are able to work with the vendors that we'll be able to move forward on the initiative.
So, Mr. Mossman, you are still standing by the $82 million as a target?
Mr. Chairman, I'm nervous, but I'm still standing by the $82
million. Okay, good. We passed the budget based on that, so Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, exactly. That's what I hope we'll come back and have a report, as hard as it is. But I was just at a national early childhood meeting, and they would always say there's not enough data, and we don't know what's happening, and Head Start's a failure because it hasn't met these requirements, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I hope, you know, we're going to have to, I don't know what when you actually know the budget. I guess we know the budget, but when we know whether you've met or not met it. But now that we've put all these interesting, innovative initiatives on the table, we have to see if they're working the way they thought we would. So I hope you'll hear either during session or whenever we can.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think it's important that we as a committee get periodic updates on how these initiatives are going.
We'll certainly be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murray.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Massman, this number here is a biennium number, correct? So the $82 million is something that you'll be working on collecting in 2012 and 2013. So while we can have updates, we really won't know if we've met the $82 million until a year and a half out now.
Mr. Chairman, Mossman. Representative, that's correct. It's a biennial number.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything further?
I don't think so, Mr. Chairman. We look forward to more updates, and I think we'll certainly know more, I think, on the tax analytics as well as the initiative during the regular session. So.
Well, we appreciate the update and glad to hear that things are on track, even though a bit behind. And anytime you undertake a major new initiative like that, that's understandable. This is an important initiative. I know the department feels that way, and so does the committee. And so we hope that we will continue to get some periodic updates on how things are going. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And members, don't forget to fill out your reimbursement forms for our meeting today. We have a budget, not a huge budget, but we have a budget to accommodate our expenses for this meeting. So anything else for the good of the order today? Thank you for being here, and the meeting is adjourned.